a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Okay, well, I want to welcome everyone on the committee back, and looks like we've got almost a full committee. I want to thank you. And those of you that are here in the audience today, welcome. And to everyone that we are this tuned in to us on the internet. And so with that, I will call the meeting of the Executive Board Monday, August 22nd to order, and I'd ask the clerk to please call the roll.
Senators Gray.
Here.
Hunstad.
Here.
Maher.
Here.
Nelson.
Here.
Tiedemann.
Here.
Thiessen. Representatives Abdallah.
Here.
Carson.
Here.
Consett.
Here.
Feinstein.
Here.
Lucas.
Here.
Rausch.
Here.
Benner.
Here.
Vice Chair Cutler.
Here.
And Chair Tripaville.
Here.
A quorum is present.
Thank you very much. You've all received a copy of the minutes of the June 27th meeting. Are there any questions, comments, additions? If not, I'll entertain a motion.
So moved.
We have a motion and a second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. You have the agenda in front of you. Any additions, corrections to the agenda? Hearing none, I'll entertain a motion.
So moved.
Representative Rouse, seconded by Representative Benner. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. All right, before we get started, I do want to take a moment on behalf of a good friend of ours who just passed away, former representative, longtime legislator Gordon Peterson from Wall. Gordon has been around for 30-plus years. He has been a longtime member of the legislature, and he was certainly one of the individuals that we could all go to for questions. He had more knowledge and background information than anyone that I've ever seen. And for those of you that are interested and have the time, I'm just going to go through a very brief information sheet here for you. But Gordon Peterson, age 84, Wall. He died August 20th at the VA hospital in Sioux Falls. Survivors include his wife Betty Peterson Wall, two sons, Gary of Wall, James of Yankton, two daughters, Carol of Oklahoma, and Nancy Holub of Wall, four grandchildren, three sisters. Visitation will be held 5 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday, August 24th at the Wall High School gym with a prayer service at 7 p.m. Funeral services will be held 10 a.m. Thursday, August 25th at the Wall High School gym with Pastor Curtis Garland officiating. Interment with full military honors will be at the Wall Cemetery. For those of you that didn't know Gordon, he was he retired as a lieutenant colonel, having served in three wars: World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. A memorial has been established. Arrangements are with the Roush Funeral Chapel in Wall. His online guest book is available at RoushmoreFuneralHome.com. So for those of you that are able to attend, I would encourage you to do so. We know that there are going to be a large number of people because Gordon was very, very popular in and around his district and throughout the state. And so with that, if you have the time, please consider. Go ahead.
If I might, Mr. Chairman, too, I had long time service with Gordon, both on the executive branch and then in this job as well. He was a very, very interesting fellow. I had a couple chances to just sit down and talk with him for a long period of time. His stories were remarkable. And he was just fun to be around when you got to know him. If you were on the opposite side of him sometimes, there was a time when you thought, gee, this guy is pretty rough. And then you found out, nope, he was just basically a very nice guy. And for those of you who remember, he had a little encounter with that long staircase behind the House chamber, tumbled all the way to the bottom. They took him to the hospital. He showed up before session was done that day and apologized for being late. You don't get much tougher than that. I'm sorry, you just don't. So he will be missed. His personality will be missed. He was fun to be around, and he added a certain amount of value in terms of his legislative experience, but he also added a lot of value because he was such an interesting and knowledgeable human being. And I think he was good for new legislators and veteran legislators as well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. Any other comments from the committee? Seeing none. All right, we will get started on our full board agenda for right now. If you recall, at the last meeting, there were some questions in regard to the Midwest Higher Education Compact. There was a vote which ended up being 7-6 to pay the $95,000 that was committed by the state, but had not been paid by either the Board of Regents, the Governor's Office, or anyone else. We did pay that, and since then there's been quite a bit of controversy in regard to this issue. Senator Haverly, who is on that Midwest Higher Education Compact, had asked for a few minutes to come and explain in a little more detail what the compact is all about. I've asked him to be brief and to the point, and we will have at the end of his presentation a couple moments for questions, and then we will move on. So, Senator DeHaveley, welcome, and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You've already said my name, but I'll say it again for record keeping. I'm Senator Jeff Haverly from District 35 out in Rapid City, and I come to you today wearing two hats. One as a legislator and one as a commissioner serving on Midwest Higher Education Compact. Members of the E-Board, thank you, and I can't say this enough, for taking the time on your agenda to give me a chance to go over the benefits belonging to MEC. And I'll have some closing comments as to how this all came down at the end of my briefing. But today's main part is to inform you of the different programs that MEC has available to the state of South Dakota, and a small part of history with South Dakota, and the cost savings to South Dakota to date from MEC programs. South Dakota joined MEC, passing legislation in 2008. MEC is a compact that was created by the Midwest Legislative Conference of the Council of State Governments, or CSG as we know it. The reason for the development of this program was to find and develop cost savings programs, student access programs, and complete policy research and analysis. They do all this to find more efficient and effective ways to educate our citizens. While this is still the primary function of MEC, they have morphed into an organization that not only saves higher education money, but in some cases state and local governments, as well as nonprofit organizations and K-12 school systems. As those programs apply to South Dakota, we have only used a small portion of them, of which I will cover later. The first program I will cover is the MEC Cost Savings and Cost Containment Program. The idea behind this program is to achieve savings in a manner that no single entity can achieve on its own. It works because of the purchasing power of 12 states, and it is much greater than the power of a single state. The programs that exist within the cost-saving function are the Master Property Program, which is an insurance program, the Computer Hardware and Software Initiatives, hardware and software companies like MEC with MEC are names like, and you're going to recognize some of these, like Dell, Fujitsu, Oracle, Systemax, and Xerox, just to name a few. Software companies are, again, Oracle, Novell, VMware, and that's only naming a few of the companies that have contracts with MEC. They also contract with companies like Lucent, Juniper, and Mitel for data and voice networking cost savings programs. These are most of the companies, but not all, that MEC has contracts with. The insurance program insures over 100 campuses nationwide with property values exceeding $73 billion. These two areas are where South Dakota has achieved cost savings to date. And this number will reflect something that you haven't heard before because the reports come out on a fiscal year and a fiscal year basis. We were just made aware of a contract that the Board of Regents signed for software licensing. To date has been $351,000. These are documented cost savings, even though the continued savings of $85,000 to the Board of Regents properties continues to be achieved through the initial competitive bid placed by MEC. If one were to add those figures of those savings for the property insurance on a yearly total, it would bring the total to $521,000 in savings to the state of South Dakota. As higher education communities, nonprofits, and K-12 continue to utilize the vendors with MEC, the cost savings so too will grow. Another cost savings program that has just been rolled out is the student health care program. The South Dakota Board of Regents, while realizing this program has great potential for saving in our higher ed students, money, has chosen to wait until some of the national health care issues have been resolved to see where the national health insurance falls down within the states. The cost savings for the 12-state MEC region for all these programs for FY10 alone was $30.8 billion. The other challenge MEC has taken on is student access and success. It is through this program that students are able to use the Midwest Student Exchange Program. Through this program, students are able to attend programs in other states with reduced tuition through the program. 9 of 12 states currently use the Midwest Student Exchange. Students and families that utilize the program have achieved a savings of nearly $14 million. South Dakota does not currently utilize this program. However, MEC has been working closely to educate the region administration as to how the program can be beneficial to South Dakota higher education institutions. That specific program applies not only to specific schools, but specific programs as well, which allows the exchange program to be targeted to certain fields or industries, thus being able to be manipulated by the state to meet their needs. Another program within the core function of MEC is the e-transcripts, which is a service that provides transcripts from member high schools to member colleges, high school transcripts between high schools, and college transcripts between member colleges. South Dakota does not utilize this program as well. The last core function of MEC is the policy research side of MEC. It does this by many different means. First, it conducts and disseminates research on post-secondary education policy issues that could be or are of concern to educators or policymakers. It reports on key performance indicators on post-secondary education for each state to include workforce demands, preparation for college, student retention, and completion rates, along with finances and affordability issues facing our students. Another key function is one of networking for legislators or policymakers with educators, business leaders, and others to share best practices, which in many cases leads to problem solving and dialogue between the entities mentioned. MEC also maintains the Post-Secondary Education Resource Library, which is an online resource that can be used by its members that includes local, regional, national policies issues in a searchable database. One of the final things MEC does is it provides requests for data and information from higher education researchers, policymakers within the member states. I'm going to close today by going over some of the general items because I've just touched on a small part that the MEC programs offer. MEC is unique in the respect that it is governed by a 60-member commission of legislators, governor representatives, and higher education leaders. The commission rotates the chair position annually between legislator and a non-legislator. It meets annually but provides for meeting times for its many subcommittees that are formed by the commission involving higher education, legislators, business leaders, and others within the member states. Too often people compare MEC with WICHE, which is another commission which represents western states. The differences are many. To name a few, WICHE is made up of only higher education professionals. The largest difference is WICHE's main focus is one of policy and research. to demonstrate this, which he came to MEC to be included in some of the cost savings programs of which the organization has accepted for those states outside the MEC region. South Dakota was the last state to join the Midwest Higher Education Compact, keeping in mind that it takes time to grow any organization's benefits to members. Even with that, South Dakota has realized $351,000 in savings in the short 2.5 years that it has been a member. That comes to a savings of about $117,000 per year. And as stated before, that would not be taking into account the continued savings of $85,000 a year for the insurance costs for the Board of Regents building. With that figure included, it would be a savings of $521,000 for the last 3 years. If you were to include that in the per year figure, it would be somewhere around $173,000 a year. Whether you use the $117,000 or $173,000, less than $95,000, the state as a whole is achieving savings. How does this create savings for students? When the Board of Regents or any entity has extraordinary cost, because they don't have the purchase power as a single entity, those costs are reflected in terms of raising fees and tuition. We've seen that, every one of us here. As South Dakota nonprofit state agencies, or South Dakota nonprofits, state agencies, higher education, and K-12 systems learn more about MEC and its programs, more savings will be achieved. If those state savings are not realized, then perhaps South Dakota should not belong. However, I believe we should allow this administration a couple of years and a chance to find efficiencies and cost savings wherever possible, given the realities of our current economic times. Thank you, members, for your attention. I'm going to go through a couple other just highlighted points that I didn't cover. Because MEC is a statutorily created entity in each member state, state local entities can use MEC contracts without having to incur the cost of rebidding the products or services covered in the MEC contracts. MEC already conducted a thorough and competitive bid process which can be tailored to the needs of state and local entities. And if you talk to any one of our procurement people or any one of the agencies, the bid process is long, it's brutal sometimes, and it takes a lot of time and money to do those bid processes. MEC has taken this part of that out of the equation. Entities in MEC member states saved an estimated $317 million since 1991 using the MEC purchasing contracts. Since 2008, the annual state commitment has been set at $95,000. And I served on this committee for MEC as a commissioner several years back. They talked about getting more in line with the other compacts across the nation. I demanded, along with several other members, that we freeze that. We didn't need it. And so we froze it at $95,000 through at least FY13. The amount is significantly lower than the state commitment paid by states in the other three regional higher education compacts, where state commitments range from $125,000, and this has $193,000, but I know for a fact that they're higher than that. Having said all that, I said I was going to make a couple of comments. I can understand the frustration by this committee. Trust me when I say that when the bill showed up at the end of our fiscal year meeting on appropriations, it was a last-minute item as well. And as happened in the year past, we had to send it on to the E-Board. We are in talks, of course, as we have been previously, with the governor's office, a new administration, to make sure that this line item gets placed back into the Board of Regents funding stream. I, if anybody, am to blame for that. Being an appropriator sometimes has its ups and downs for those who have served on appropriations or those who might want to. We were faced with a very large deficit last year, and to be honest with you, this was an oversight on my part. No excuses, just an oversight. It should have been placed back in a line item and voted on at that time. I can assure you that that won't happen again. There's no blame except to me because of the Appropriations Committee dealing with those cuts and we didn't ever think of MEC until we received the bill at the end of the fiscal year. And that essentially is that. The other one last thing that I'd like to remind the committee, I can understand your frustration with the way it came down. And again, I'm learning. I'm a slow learner sometimes. Adala knows that. Don't be frustrated at the way the method of the funding came down and the bill at the end of the year. I can empathize with you, and I would be as frustrated as you. But don't blend that with the program of MEC. Keep the two items separate. And as I said, I can assure you that that's not going to happen next year. Up or down, it's not going to happen next year. But keep the programs and the value of those programs as a separate argument. And I think you're going to see South Dakota continue to grow. I've handed out some information, and that information covers basically what I did very lightly. I have a couple of full-blown packages on MEC programs. I have about four of them with me if anybody's interested in taking a look. The one thing that I ask you to do is get out in your communities, your nonprofit organizations. There's been many cities across South Dakota that have already utilized, just to name a few, Dual School District, Douglas School District, Enemy Swim Day School, Marty Indian School, Millbank School, Mitchell School District, Rapid City School District, Sioux Falls School District. Governments are City of Brandon, City of Mitchell, City of Sturgis Police Department, Coddington County, Grant County, Marshall County, Meade County, South Dakota Science and Technology Authority, Sully County Emergency Management. For software, the South Dakota Board of Regents, which we just found out about 3 days ago, signed a $124,900 savings with a MEC contract for computer software licensing. And as you know, you have to do that on an annual basis. So they'll also realize a $27,000 annual savings with the MEC contract. Higher ed systems that have used it are Black Hills State University, Dakota Wesleyan, South Dakota Board of Regents, South Dakota State University, and University of Sioux Falls. The MEC contracts that are available right now change. When the contract time comes up with a company such as Dell, other hardware companies like HP and others come to the table and try to present a bid. So they take all the legwork out of it. And if you do run into your local town or school district that's interested in MEC, don't let them just go to the website. Have them contact MEC. And if they're frustrated about something, have them contact MEC, because that's who will do the legwork for them in making sure that their needs are met. With that, I'm going to open it up for any questions that anybody might have.
All right. Thank you, Senator Haverly. And any questions or comments from anyone in the committee? Representative Abdullah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Senator, I don't know enough about the program to argue either way. My objection last e-board meeting was the way it was presented, the way it was handled. Never in the experience that I've been in this legislature has anybody, whether e-board, House, or Senate, passed on something, and 15 minutes later it's run through the auditor's office and a check was cut and put in the mail. I didn't like that. That was an 11th-hour backdoor deal. I still don't like it. I don't like the fact that it wasn't put on the agenda. It was brought in at after 4 o'clock, the day of the e-board meeting, and before 5 o'clock, the check was cut and in the mail. That's wrong. If that's what we're going to do, then I see no reason for me to propose bills to the legislature, go before the House committee, the Senate committee, the House body, and the Senate body, and go down for the governor's signature when I can come to the e-board and all I have to do is snow 7 people up here and pass the same kind of legislation. That is wrong. The governor cut that out of his bill, out of his budget. Evidently, the Appropriations Committee didn't want to mess with it. And then it comes to us. You mentioned that excuse me, the end of session, it didn't get taken care of, so it came to the E-Board. It came to the E-Board 6 months later. It came to the E-Board June 27th, a little over a month ago. Am I correct, Mr. Chairman?
That is correct.
Right now, we've got a moot point. I mean, what's done is done. You handed out this informational chart, and I'm looking. MEC program savings for 12 months. South Dakota, $52,001. You've been throwing figures around, and I don't disbelieve you, but that isn't what the chart says. Now, South Dakota is in a state like Illinois where they saved $11,314,000. And like I said, I don't know that much about the program to argue pros or cons. I just didn't like the way it was presented. We were also told at the committee that MEC offers discounted tuition, out-of-state tuition for our students, which was kind of an oxymoron. We're trying to keep our students in-state. That's why we have the governor's scholarship program. And we were told that this gives us discounts for tuition out-of-state. Now I find out through you that South Dakota doesn't participate in that part of it. So, but that's what we were told. Now, obviously the vote was 7-6, so it isn't a solid sell on anybody's part. I don't like the fact that we got a 3-year contract. If this legislature repeals it, we still have to pay for 2 years. Now, I visited with the Attorney General, and he said if we repeal the bill, there's no way that they can make us pay for 2 years on that contract. No way. He said we may have to pay a little bit, but we certainly aren't going to pay $190,000. And secondly, I read somewhere where MEC was asked if they would sue us, and they didn't commit either way. But like I said, I don't have a complaint about the program in itself. I certainly don't have a complaint with you, Senator, but I object to the fact that it came before this body at 4:15, and before 5 p.m. that same day, the check was cut out of the auditor's office and mailed. And this legislature doesn't do business like that, and you know they don't. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Lucas, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Haverly, I appreciate the information that you've given us here this morning. I was one of the no votes on the June 27th meeting, primarily because I wasn't sure how many institutions were utilizing this program, and also the process. I felt that maybe the governor's office had some responsibility to pay the dues. My other question, or two of them, would be, you said, you know, like Enemy Day Swim and Marty participated in some savings. Can our private colleges and tribal schools also access bid savings or tuition reduction or anything along that line? And can there be another way of funding it, such as maybe on a user basis for those that really want to participate it based upon their tuition numbers or enrollment numbers? Those are my questions, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator, can you be very brief?
I'll be as brief as possible. I do want to go back to Senator. I'm Representative Abdallah, some of his things. Representative Abdallah, I agree. I don't do business that way either. And I, as I've stated in my testimony, I take full responsibility for that. As far as the cost savings sheet that you see there, those are to save money. Those are printed on an annual basis, and the companies that MEC does business with reports on an annual basis. We have taken the initiative to both contact the companies to make sure we have an up-to-date listing for South Dakota because of what was brought up. Not only that, but we had planned long before this controversy to go visit with many of the state agencies, which we've done, and the governor's office, on fully supporting MEC. So those are old figures. The figures that I have, if you want a copy, I can most certainly burn a copy of this, and it has the cost savings to date. MEC themselves found out what the deal with the Board of Regents and Oracle just last week when we met with the Board of Regents office. And we weren't even aware of that because Oracle doesn't report that except on a fiscal year basis at the end of the year. So the $127,000, it was like, it was a great deal for South Dakota. And we've watched it year after year, or at least I have, grow from $6,000 used to $50,000 to whatever. So the cost savings are there. So that chart, that's what MEC wanted you all to have as board members. If you have any other questions, I can answer those. As far as private schools, if they're nonprofit, are eligible for these cost savings. The towns and some of the schools that I've mentioned don't even know they achieve those cost savings because of the membership with MEC. It's wise that they say that they're members of MEC because then they may get a realize another discount. But we need to get the word out, both MEC. I think everybody has a responsibility to their communities and their state and their citizens to make sure they do that. As far as the student exchange, back to Representative Dollar, very briefly, I mentioned that in my statement. The Board of Regents here was not aware that those programs can be tailored to specific schools or specific programs. That, in fact, can happen. So if we have somebody from another state that wants to use our agricultural program at SDSU, we can tailor that to that program and only allow that reduced rate of coming in. Search, if you will, Google North Dakota and Wall Street Journal, and you'll see they're part of this program. They have realized money that they never thought existed within their higher ed system. They're not losing students because of this program. They're very similar to South Dakota. They're actually gaining enrollment. And some of those students that are coming to North Dakota are staying in North Dakota. As far as the user, you had a question about what was a...
Mr. Chair, I guess it'd be, can the dues be charged as a user?
Illinois just went through this. It's very difficult because if you base it on a user basis, I mean, you heard the areas that I mentioned. How do you break that down into percentages to what we're talking about? $1 million purchases. We're talking about $20,000 purchases. We're talking about $5,000 purchases. So it's very hard to break the percentage down. The state has at least a small responsibility if they belong to the program because they're the overseers of everybody. They're who everybody can come to. And I've been working extremely hard with the governor's office to win his support for this program. And hopefully at the end of the day, he will come out in support of. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Are there any other questions or comments? Seeing none? Thank you. I'm sure we'll hear more about this at a later date.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Nice seeing you all.
All right, next item on our agenda is the Investment Council Subcommittee Report. Before we get into that, I'd like to recognize one individual sitting out here, a longtime member of the LRC. Jackie Storm is no longer a member of the LRC. You are going to see her now appear with the State Investment Council. Jackie, congratulations. You know we're going to miss you here. I hope we will see you during the legislative session, but I know you are going to be a very valuable member of the Investment Council, and I want to congratulate you and wish you best luck. You're welcome. Okay. Mr. Clark. When you're ready, gentlemen, please introduce yourself and we'll get started.
Now is it on?
It is.
Thank you for having us here today. My name is Joe Anglin. I'm from Spriffer, South Dakota. I'm starting my fifth year of the Investment Council chair. I'm the chair in the last year. And in front of you, you're going to soon have this document. And the first thing I'd like to do is introduce the council members. And if you'd stand up so to be noted, Wes Cheddar will be the chair next year. He's the vice chair this year from Brookings. And Hugh Bartles, I'm not sure if he made it. Nope, he's from Watertown. John Hunter from Madison. Jim Means is our newest member from Yankton. Jared Johnson, School and Public Lands. And Richard Satgast, State Treasurer. And Rob Wiley, South Dakota Retirement Systems. I'd also like to introduce the four important members of Matt's team. And they are the three assistant investment officers, Brett Fliggy, Chris Nelson, and Tammy Otten. And if Matt, like Matt spoke earlier, if he gets hit by a truck, those are the three people that will run the show while Matt's out. And Lori Riss is the business manager, which we all rely on very much. So on page one, you can see the organizational chart for this organization. And the Investment Council's role is macro, in that we set policy, we evaluate the performance of the funds that are managed, we recommend Matt's investment compensation each year, and then we have an audit done each year of the internal controls, which we use the state for that audit. Jumping to page two is a graphical representation of the assets under management. And you can see under 2011, as of June 30th, our end of our fiscal year, that we have almost made it back to the high of 2007. So for all practical purposes, at that point, we'd come back from the market fall off in the years following that. Page three gives you some return information. And I'm going to start at the top, and on the left column there, you can see that the South Dakota Retirement Systems, we're just talking about this one fund out of the many funds that we manage. The return for the fiscal year was 25.84. I think Matt said last night that was about fourth or fifth best return we've had in 38 years. And compared to the three benchmarks listed there, the Mellon corporate plan, they had a 19.68 return. We beat them by 6% for the year. The capital market benchmark, which is our own benchmark that we try to compare ourselves against, 22% return there. If we would have just followed the benchmark, we would have made a 22% return. We outperformed that by 3.78. And then the state fund universe, this is other public funds in other states. It's non-audited, but we're estimating that to be about a 21.5% return. Outperformed all three of those benchmarks. Looking to the right there, you can see the 7 years that Matt has been in charge since Steve retired. And you can see that on a seven-year period, it's been 7.8% return, and he outperformed over those 7 years by 1-plus percent. And then looking at the last 10 years, a 7% return overall, also outperforming there. Just below that, you can see the beginning value of the South Dakota Retirement Systems and the ending value, and that's net of contributions from employees and employers and then minus payments for those who have retired. At the very bottom, the total dollars earned this year before, you know, the net withdrawals, $1.654 billion. That's the 25.84% return in dollar amount. And in the last 3 years, it's been $3.5 billion, and 10 years, it's been $4.3 billion. The extra earnings that this team earns over those benchmark returns, you can see at the very bottom. So if we would have been in those benchmarks only, we wouldn't have had the extra returns that are listed at the bottom. And the last year, that extra return over those benchmarks returns ranged from $245 million to $400 million. That's added value. Rob Wiley mentioned at our earlier subcommittee meeting that $400 million for Mellon Analytics, that equates to $5,000 per person that's in the South Dakota Retirement System accounts. So we have 75,000 members. That extra performance equals $5,000 per member. And that's just a nice number to know that's there for that extra performance. Page four, I'm going to start on the left-hand column there. In the last year, you can see the red dot is how the returns turned out for the South Dakota retirement system compared to the billion-dollar corporate fund. The green dot is if we had just followed our internal benchmark that we set at the beginning of each year. So you can see that we outperformed our benchmark and we outperformed the billion-dollar corporate funds. You can see the dark line there is the median return. At the very bottom, you can see that we were in the fifth percentile. And actually, it's just a little bit above the fifth percentile is how we did. Looking further to the right, which are the more important numbers, is how have we done over the years? One-year returns, there's a lot of fluctuation. But you can see over the years, starting on the 20-year return, you can see we're in the top. That little red dot is at the top. And the 10-year, the same. And on the 7-year, it's also in the same. What's very important in this group is that we look at the long term, we manage for the long term, and we want to produce the returns for the long term at the lowest cost we can. Page 5 gives a little bit of a picture of the total fund return. On the top half of that page, if you look at the 38 years, look to the right, you can see that the overperformance over the 38 years has been 88 basis points. 88% of 1% in 38 years is how much they've overperformed. Just below that for the 10-year picture, you can see in the last 10 years that overperformance has been 1.29% return. And we'll see later why that overperformance, how it benefits the funds themselves in the long run. On the bottom half of that page, in the numbers area, you can see 2010 and 2011. The overperformance last year in 2010 was 7.61%. That was the biggest one-year overperformance ever done in 38 years. This year, our outperformance was 3.78%. So that's a very good fourth or fifth best return ever. When we talked earlier about those excess earnings, what this page 6 shows you is if we would earn 88 basis points over performance every year going forward, that would equal by the year 2032 an extra $5.4 billion of money sitting in those accounts to benefit those beneficiaries. Even if we would do half of that, 88 basis points, the benefit over those years would be $2.6 billion. So that extra performance over the years really does benefit in the long term. Page 7 shows you a little bit of a picture of how costly we are compared to if we were to manage these, farm these funds out to be managed elsewhere. On the very left there, you see 91 basis points. That's the cost of the internal cost of the management of this fund. Immediately to the right of that, you can see if the total cost, including the internally managed cost and the externally managed cost. So the total cost of the fund was 36 basis points. If you go 4 to the right, you can see the benchmark for similar size and asset mixed funds. If we were to totally farm out the management of this fund and not do anything in-house, it would cost us about 86 basis points. So that kind of gives you some perspective on how cheaply we manage those funds. On the very bottom of that page in that paragraph, you will see that the savings in a dollar estimate is $52 million per year. By managing these funds in-house and not out-house, that equates to about $52 million in savings per year that is able to benefit the funds going forward. That's one of the most important pages to me, is between the returns and the cost savings. On page 8, we're going to take a look at the fiscal 2011 year budget that was received. In that left column, you can see that the total budget received that year was $8.9 million. How much did we actually spend? At the very bottom, you can see is $6.9 million. So the savings that, compared to what we budgeted, was roughly $2 million. Most of that savings comes from the fact that we budget for an incentive, hoping that we're going to hit 100% over incentive, which on average we only hit 50% on average over the years. So the savings this year was $1.2 million there on that incentive. Looking at the bottom of the personal services category, you can see that the personal services savings was about $1.5 million. In the bottom half of that operating expenses, you can see we saved about $452,000, and we'll go through that on the next page. I guess I just want to emphasize that actual expenditure of $6.9 million in cost there. If we farmed everything out, that number would be closer to an additional $52 million in cost. At the very bottom of page 8, the savings from 1 year get rolled over into the next year, so it makes it so we have less to fund the next year. Page 8 takes a picture of the contractual services and the savings there. At the top, you can see the second line item, Stephen Myers contract. We were always paying in arrears there, but this number is a 5 quarters. We paid him up for, brought him current, and we're done with Steve Myers as far as a contract relationship as of June 30th. So you can see that that program, even though it's a little bit over budget, it is done now. A little bit further down there, I just note that Standard & Poor's 1200 costs, the $8,000 that we expended there to do the IRAN-free adjustment to that Standard & Poor's 1200, that's going to go away because we're no longer going to need that service. But that's why that category is over a little bit, as we had to pay that extra cost. Fourth category down, there's a flexibility line item. $206,000 was budgeted. We didn't spend anything there. So that's a large part of the savings. And then bottom line, you can see that the savings overall was $414,000 on the contractual services part of the budget. Page 10 is a snapshot picture of the long term of what we expect to happen going out 10 years. And you can see at the very top line, you can see the number of employees that we expect to grow to. You can see compensation funded 100%. As you go down through these, you just see them growing based on growth of the assets. On the very bottom, the unit cost summary, the important line there is the middle one of those three. We talked about 9 basis points was the cost for internally managed funds. The goal is always to stay at 10 basis points or less. And you can see that their estimates here going forward, that they should stay at that 10 basis points or less going forward. Even given the growth that's going to occur in the future, the way they plan to manage a large part of these assets in-house at a lower cost, we should be able to keep that cost down. I think Matt mentioned earlier to me or last night that that number was 11 basis points a year or so ago, and that's because the assets had been shrunk down where they've grown back now.
Yeah, in previous years when we've been asked about, hey, are we at 10 basis points, and 1 year we went to 11, well, that will vary based on the market going up or down. So if our expenses were flat and the market fell, then our percentage as an expense would go up. And so when the markets are at the bottom, that number will drift up, and when the markets are high, the number will go down. And so when we're looking at 10, we're looking at it on the basis of, well, what if most markets were around fair value to smooth that out? Right now, that's probably about the case overall, or markets might be a little bit cheap yet. And also we're thinking about normalizing for demographics in our office. We have a lot of young people, and as they become older, that number goes up. And then at some point, as the young people become veterans, some of the old-timers will start to retire off, and then we'll get to kind of a normal mix of older and younger people. But right now, we have more younger people than we normally would.
Page 11 is the 2013 budget request. In the far left column, you will see the 2012 amount that was received. Bottom line, that was $8.7 million. And then you see three versions, version A, version B, and version C. What the investment council recommended to the subcommittee this morning is version B. And the differences between them really come down to, in the past, we'd always budget at 100% of the incentive. On average, that always came in at about 50% on average over the years. Last year, with the budget cuts, we budgeted 85% of that 100% previously budgeted. And version B, what it's asking for is over a 3-year period to start stepping back up to that 100% budgeted level. So this will go from 85 to a 90% incentive level.
And if I could add, The version B also would restore the 5% cut that happened in compensation for the year that we're in now over a three-year period as well. And so there's an extra 5%, one-third of 5%, so an extra 1.6% would go into base salaries in version B on top of the normal long-term plan increases that are in version A. And so the only difference between version A and B is the extra 1.6% in base salaries for investment positions to restore a third of the 5% cut from last year. And then, yeah, roll up that incentive coverage for the funding from one-third of the way back to 100% from the 85% that it went to last year. Had always been at 100% before. It was cut to 85% last year as part of the budget cut. And this would move us a third of the way back with the idea that eventually we want to get back to 100% funding of that, so we're covered in case that contingency arises. Whether we're funded 85 or 100 has nothing to do with what's actually paid out, as long as the average incentive paid out in any given year is under 85%. So it just covers us for contingency and means that we turn back more money unspent at the end of the year in most cases.
Just to give you a little bit background on the personal services, about a year and a half ago we had a salary study done by Deloitte, and the target of the investment council is always to take what the salaries would be in the marketplace and discount it by 30%, and that's what our long-term plan has always been. At that time, a year and a half ago when we had that study done, it showed that we had fallen down to about 35%. Because the salaries in the marketplace have come up in the last year and a half, in the New York area and the different money management areas, we feel that we're probably down behind that curve more than 35% at this point. Could be closer to 45%, maybe even 50%. We will update that salary study in another year and a half. We do it about every 3 years. Just to go through the version A a little bit closer, of the three different versions, the version C had some controversy. There are some that feel in our council that we should have recommended C, because we feel it is important that we don't mess with the salaries and lose these staff that we've trained for long term. But in the end, what we agreed on was the version B, which is to start stepping back up to what we think is a discounted 30% ratio. Is there any questions that any of you have on that area?
Yes, go ahead.
Can you clarify, Matt, did you and your staff, am I hearing this correctly, that you took a 5% salary cut across the board?
Yes. To clarify, senior staff on July 1 took a 5% pay cut relative to the year before. Just to add context, those positions' salaries were flat the 2 years before that. And so pay for myself and the senior investment people who were introduced earlier is now 5% below the three-year-ago level for base salaries. For junior staff, all these young people that were migrating up over time, we diminished the amount of their increase for their promotional increases by 5% as well. So everybody took a 5% cut relative to what they otherwise were going to get, you know, which was zero for senior people. So 5% from zero is minus five. And then for a young person, they might have originally been going to go up anywhere from 10 to 20%. And some of that was the COLA structure that we used to keep up with the investment industry, which was 4.8%. So we took that away to go to a zero salary policy, and then we cut an extra five. So if someone was going to get a 12% increase, they might have ended up getting a couple. If they were going to get 20, they would have ended up getting 10. And if you were going to get just the 4.8 originally, that was cut to zero and then minus five ultimately. Does that answer it?
Any other questions, comments from the committee? Thank you.
On page 12, we'll switch over to the operating expenses section of the budget. And if you look at the very bottom line, you can see that version A, B, and C all have the same number at the bottom there for 2013, which is $514,000. and last year we received $787,000. Most of those savings are coming from the custodial fees global line there. At the third from the bottom, we have a custodial account with Bank of New York, and we had expected that fees to be a lot larger than they ended up coming in. So there's a lot of savings there. And page 13, Matt's going to talk a little bit about the trust funds.
The final returns for the trust funds ended up being between 20 and 21%. I'll just run through the four trust funds quickly, starting with the healthcare trust at the top of page 13. The principal value is $85.6 million. If we had kept up with inflation in that fund over time, we need the assets to have gone up to $106 million. In fact, as of June 30th, they're $107.9 million. So we've succeeded in preserving the principal, making the payouts over time, and keeping up with inflation with a million or $2 to spare for that fund. That means that compared to principal, we're $18.4 million ahead. And there was a distribution that happened on July 1, and we factored that in. And so after that, we've now fallen a bit behind keeping up with inflation. And so return of 20.65%. Long term, we only expect to earn 6.4% out of this fund. And we do expect around 3% inflation embedded in that. And if we're paying out 4, which is the formula, and inflation's going to be 3, we need to earn 7 to keep up with inflation, and we don't quite expect to be able to do that. And so we hope over time we can keep up with most of inflation, but we'll have to add some value to fully keep up with it or just have the markets do better than we expect. The distribution, which was just paid out, was the $3.876 million, which was appropriated last session. And then for the education trust, the original principal, $329.3 million. To have kept up with inflation, we need to be at $408.4 million. We're not. We are at $391.6 million. And that's good news compared to where we were, you know, the last couple of years. Compared to the principal, we're $47.8 million ahead. And if you remember 2 years ago, going into session, just a year and two-thirds ago in November when I presented the interim returns to you right before session started, we were behind principal, and we needed a rally in the last 2 weeks of the calendar year just to get up to principal so you would even have a payout. And, well, those days, you know, have been replaced by now we're $47.8 million ahead. And so that's good news that we have some cushion now to help buffer us in the event markets turn back down again.
Yeah.
Matt, shouldn't those two lines be reversed there in the education enhancement? The fair market value, shouldn't that be the 408 and then the principal, the 391?
The numbers are correct as presented. I wish the market value were $408 million, but it's not. What they are, again, is the original money deposited into the trust fund, you know, which principally came from the tobacco monies in the education enhancement fund, $329 million. If we grow that $329 million at inflation, just to keep a side calculation, keep track of, hey, what's the bogey that we'd like to be keeping up with so that we can say we've kept up with inflation, we would need to be at the $408 million. Now, when the accountants tally up the fair value of everything in the fund, they tell us it's worth $391.6 million. And so we've done very well compared to the $329 million, you know, making those payouts and growing the fund, you know, $47.8 million ahead of the payouts we've made. But we haven't done quite as well as we would need to have kept up with inflation, which is probably, you know, a difficult task. We never expected to keep up with inflation. Our original projections were that we would struggle to keep up with inflation based upon our long-term projections. Given our projection for inflation and the payouts and our assumed returns, we didn't think we would make it. And we're, in fact, we're very close to what we actually expected, which is probably a fluke over such a short-term period of time. But we have not kept up with inflation. We're $31 million behind. And so just know that we're eroding the purchasing power of that fund a bit when we make those payouts. We've lost money in purchasing power. In nominal terms, in dollar terms, we've made money, but we've lost money in purchasing power. But we did make another $14.4 million distribution, and we at least have the $47 million cushion to help tide us over if markets get even worse than they are so far this fiscal year. And then if I may continue on to Dakota Cement Trust. Original principal, $238 million. We took $12 million out right away, so we really only had $226 million to invest. That $238 would need to have grown to $301 to have kept up with inflation, which it's not, and that's really going to be a struggle because there's effectively that $12 million withdrawal every year is more like 5% plus of the value of that fund. And so if we only think we can earn, you know, 6-something, and inflation's 3, we're just not going to keep up unless we do better than we expect. And we are ahead of principal, though. First time in a long time that's been the case, at $242 million, better than the $238 original, and even more better than the $226 we really started with. And the return on that one was 21%. And then down to School and Public Lands Fund, its return was 20.4%. All these trust funds are managed basically the same. The only difference in the returns is because of the different timings of when money comes in and out of them. You know, if the money happens to come out for a distribution when the market's lower, you know, that's worse. And if we need to raise the money to make a distribution when the market's higher, that's better. And given that the distributions are made at different times for some of these different funds, that affects the investments at the margin. We try to keep them as close to the same as we can, but there's going to be minor differences. Any questions on that, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Feinstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just trying to read this. For example, in the health care or education trust fund, it says after the 7/1/2012 distribution, the $31 million right now is, you have it. Where is it? Is it in the cash flow account, or you just have it in your funds, and then we pay it out then, and then
the $31 million distribution, negative number there, if I may, or which number are you?
Yeah. It says after this.
Okay, that is
a year from now.
That is simply a comparison of how much money's in the fund after we've paid the $14 million out, compared against what the principal should have grown to had we kept up with inflation. So it's just a tally of are we ahead or behind our goal of keeping up with inflation. And it says that after the $14 million was paid out, it looks like we're $31 million behind keeping up with inflation. So that money doesn't exist. It's a comparison of what we have against what we wish we would have had we kept up with inflation.
I think, Mr. Chairman, I think the confusion is it says after the 7/1/12 distribution. So you're talking about a year from now. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me.
I didn't notice that.
12 distribution that was made on July 1 and 11.
Okay.
I didn't notice that because
that was
I didn't see what it said instead of what it meant to say. Okay. Thank you.
That's throughout then in the health care.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank
you. Those were made just a month and a half ago.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions, comments?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Venner.
I'm just a little bit confused on the inflation figure. So it's a new guy question, I guess. I mean, if I look at this, and you just take the healthcare, take education, the jump from the $85 million to the $106 million, if you look at healthcare, and then the the jump in education. And then I, if you do that math real quick, that's like 24.7%. And the other one, am I doing that math right? What am I missing here, Matt?
To use the healthcare trust fund as the example, we started with a principal value of $85 million. The Constitution and the statutes say that we've got to make this 4% payout that the legislature has adopted by statute and try to grow the fund over time to protect the purchasing power. And so we do the calculation for you of what the principal would need to have grown to in order for it to have kept up with what inflation was from the time that they were established. So that you can judge how we're doing, not in terms of how's the investments office doing, because that's a function of what the opportunities are. You know, we have benchmarks for that to judge that. But what's the whole, how do you judge whether we're paying out too much money out of these funds or making the right trade-off between eating purchasing power of the funds versus preserving it? And so the calculation was put in there so that people could see if we're ahead or behind of keeping up with inflation. The reason that people were interested that originally was at first the markets were very strong when these things were put in place, and we jumped way ahead of principal, and people said, well, can't we take that extra money out? And some said, well, yeah, but you need to grow to keep up with inflation, so you've got to keep track of how much you should have grown to keep up with inflation so you can see if you're ahead or behind that. So we may be nicely ahead of principal in this fund, $18 million, but how much are we really ahead when you take into account the fact there's been inflation, you know, in the last number of years since it was put in place? And have we really earned anything extra? And the answer is no. You know, we're $1.9 million behind after the July 1 distribution that was just made. So while we're $18 million ahead of where we started, we really need to be, you know, $20 million ahead of where we started to have simply kept up with inflation and not eaten into the real purchasing power of this fund. So there really isn't any more money in there than there was when we started, adjusted for inflation. And so that's why we show that, so you can keep track of are we really ahead or not when you take inflation into account.
All right. Any other questions? Senator Cutler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What inflation ratio are you using? Is it the CPI or?
I think for these we're just using the CPI.
Other questions? All right, proceed. Thank you.
This is the compensation and return linked incentive methodology review. And what this is basically showing how we've calculated the payout for the incentives. At the top, you can see, just a reminder again, we had a 25.84% return, and the large peer universe was just slightly under 20%. The investment council's capital market benchmark was 22%. So the added value is 3.78% compared to the benchmark. And on a long-term basis, the 38-year since we've been in existence, we're ranked number one of all the those that we compare against. We're ranked the highest we can be ranked. And then the second bullet point there, that return equates to a $1.65 billion increase in value that was produced this year. So the outperformance that was added over those two benchmarks listed there in the third bullet point, just to remind you, if we would have just stayed in the benchmark, we would have returned X, but we managed the money differently, and the added value that was added there was $245 million compared to the benchmark, the capital market benchmark, and then $400 million when we compared to our peer universe. Taking into account that, those returns based on our incentive program that we have in place for the employees, the fourth bullet point, the incentive program is based on a one-year return and a four-year return. We don't want to incent these people to game the system in a one-year period. We actually weight the one-year at one-third and the four-year at two-thirds. So there is a two-third emphasis on a four-year return to tie into our long-term plan that we like to keep in front of them. Given that, Matt's payout this year was 67.7% of his base compensation, and that equates to $263,203.19. If you look at that fourth bullet point a little bit further there, the second sub-bullet point, that payout is roughly 0.1% of the added value of the capital benchmark and 0.1% of the added value of the peer universe. I mentioned earlier that the 75,000 accounts increased in value $5,000 per account. That cost per account equates to $3.50 per account is what that costs them to get the $5,000 outperformance. Second from the bottom bullet point there, the compensation, we talked earlier about the 30% haircut or discount that we try to target as the salary level for the staff based on what they could make in the marketplace. I'm just reemphasizing that it's a low-cost fund is the general idea there. And we really believe in tying their performance incentive pay to the long term. That's why we weight the 4-year at 2/3 and the 1-year at 1/3. Overall, the total incentive paid out this year will be $1.6 million to all the staff. And just to remind you that the staff share with administrative staff part of their incentive. It doesn't come out of the general budget. And I guess I would entertain any questions and
questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Gray.
I have several questions, if
please,
if I could. Please.
Go ahead.
To either one of you, just a few questions. Can you talk a little bit about the outside management? I show that as about $2.7 billion. You have a figure in here that for the total expenses, internal management plus outside management, but nothing separate for outside management. What is that? The average cost for outside management come to?
Yeah, if I can take that, or Joe and I were just talking about that last night to calculate that. Basically, 9 basis points of internal cost. That's our budgeted amount, and that's actually our long-term plan amount, and we're below our long-term plan. So the actual you saw on the bottom of the version A, B, and C budgets, which are more like the 7 type basis point numbers. But at the higher long-term plan cost, internal cost as a percentage of total assets, 9 basis points. 9 basis points is 0.09%, which is the same as 91 cents per $1,000. So sorry for the confusion of talking basis points at times and not 91 cents per $1,000 at times. They're the same thing. 9.1 basis points is 91 cents per $1,000. And then the other number, $3.66, that's rearranged in basis point terms, that would be 36.6 basis points, 0.366 of 1% of assets. And that is the outside fees added to our internal 9.1. Now, the internal managed assets are ballpark around 70% of the assets. And so you can see that by outsourcing the 30%, it makes the total go up almost fourfold. And so if just 30% of assets can raise the whole thing, you know, to that high level, you know, then we can algebraically infer that the total cost is closer to 1% of assets for those outside managed 30% part. And and then on top of it, for partnership forms of outside managers, most of our outside is in partnerships, whether it's distressed debt funds or real estate or private equity, there's also a 20% profit share to the partner. So after the base fees are deducted from the return, then, and there's typically a preferential rate of return, we might get 8% first. And then after that, they get 20% of any profit, including enough extra to get the total up to 20%. If they make 20% return for us, for example, they're going to get a 4% fee of the assets, which is 20% of the total profit for that year. And so that applies to the partnership formats, and they're not included in these because you don't know what the return is going to be and hence what that 20% profit sharing is. And it's not in ours or the comparisons because the industry convention is to show the explicit base fees for those partnerships and just denote that there's separate profit sharing on top of it. And so there are years when we'll have outside managers, have tremendous returns, and they'll get, many, many tens of millions of dollars of a share of the profits. And that's the only way that you can access private equity or these opportunistic real estate funds is through those base fee plus 20% of profits type arrangements, much like a hedge fund. Other peers of ours would have a lot invested in hedge funds as well, and we have a little bit in that. They're usually 2% base fee and 20% of profits as well. But most things that others do that falls into their hedge fund allocation, we do internally with our own team back in Sioux Falls that is paid for out of that 9 basis points. And so that's really the big secret. There are three ways that we save money. One, we manage most of the equities in-house and high yield in-house, and 9 basis points is cheaper than what we would pay outside for those categories. Number two, we do some of the fancy hedge fund type stuff, the arbitrage strategies and some distressed debt internally that might cost 1 to 2% base fees and 20% of profits outside. We do that internally within our 9 basis points. And then number three, the outside private equity and real estate partnerships, we tend to concentrate our holdings more than our peers, and so we get better volume discounts with how much we invest in each of these people because we do the work ourselves and have more confidence in who we're investing with, so we don't spread out to as many of the partners. Most of our peers would go through fund of funds arrangements that are spread out among a lot more funds. Therefore, they don't get volume discounts and they have higher cost. Plus, the fund of funds manager will charge an override fee on top of that, often as much as another percent, which raises the cost quite a bit on that. And we don't use any fund of funds. We invest directly ourselves in all those things. And we're the only fund I really can think of that does that all internally without any consultants of any type. Does that help?
Yes, that does help. One other question, if I could. If you took your shop right now, I'm not in any way suggesting this, but I just want to get a sense of what if we took $10 billion and went to the institutional investment world and ask them to manage it, how much would it cost to manage?
It depends on how we ask them to manage it. If we went to an index fund for equities, if you said they could keep security lending revenue, which is money they get from loaning your securities out to hedge funds, to short stock, for example, then you could probably have that done for just letting them keep the security lending revenue. Very, very nominal, almost nothing. Like our 9 basis points is almost nothing. Well, you could hire this done for half of that or even less in terms of equity indexes in the U.S. So virtually nothing would be the cost to index in large scale. If you wanted it actively managed, if you found managers that were very in demand and doing well and capacity constrained, they won't discount, and you might pay a half a percent to a full percent on international or complex things. If you're dealing with U.S. stuff And if the manager is struggling with their performance and they're losing clients or they're just not succeeding well in the market, so they're discounting, you might get it for 15 to 20 basis points, might be typical, which would be half again to double our internal cost. So you can hire asset management cheaply if you stick with plain vanilla, you know, virtually free if you go to indexes. Bond index funds charge a little bit more than free, so they do charge something. And we might, because that's more labor intensive, there are thousands of securities you have to sample index it as opposed to just buy all the stocks like in a stock index. And so that would probably cost more like our 9 basis points, might be illustrative. On the high yield side, and we manage our corporate high yield and distressed internally, there you're probably going to pay half a percent on up. And if it's plain vanilla high yield, it'll be more like a half a percent or maybe 80 basis points even for the good firms like we would use, those that are succeeding in the marketplace, not the discounters. Some people we don't want. If they have to discount, we probably don't want them. And if we did distressed, then we might pay maybe 1% base fee, maybe 1.5%. It depends on whether they do large security sizes or they do smaller, high volume of small things, which are more labor intensive. So and with one manager we have, it's more like 2.25% because it's lots of small transactions, which is more labor intensive. And then in all of those cases, they want 20% of the profits on top of it. And so it's very cheap if you don't have any of the expensive stuff, but the expensive stuff is what earns the higher returns over time. And the private equity and real estate, there's no way around for top flight firms to get that any cheaper than we are. We get the best volume discounts we can, and 1.5% base fee is kind of the typical volume discount base fee. For the size we can aggregate to by concentrating, and always 20% of profits.
Any other questions? Seeing none. Thank you, gentlemen. Do you have anything else at this time? All right. Senator Tiedemann.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, before we move off this, I think I would like to move that we accept the recommendation from the Investment Council on version B for the FY13 budget request.
Second.
We have a second by Representative Rausch. Comments?
Mr. Chair, I believe that the subcommittee this morning voted unanimously to accept version B. That's a 3-year plan to move back towards where those cuts were put in place. It's doing it incrementally. It's not jumping forward with the total restoration, but I support what they would then bring forth to the governor.
All right. Are there any other questions? Representative Rausch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would ask the committee support. I think over the years, if you look at the charts and you look at what the Investment Council has done, I think it's there's many people in this state that were part of the retirement system that owe a great debt of gratitude to their persistence and vision and how they invest their dollars. And I just would like us to figure out a way where the state legislators can participate in the same program. But I would ask for the committee support and thank the committee for the job well done.
Thank you. Other comments? Yes, Senator Gray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, part of my questions earlier were just setting up exactly how much it would cost for outside management. Every year I listen to this presentation, and I continue to be amazed that we can do this for 9 basis points internally. Now, granted, there's some outside management that runs the costs up a little bit, but nevertheless, an overall cost of 36 basis points. I, for one, last session, and as I sit here today, do not agree with the fact that we had our people take cuts last year. I think that was a mistake. We're not talking with direct taxpayer dollars. Now, we'd have an argument here that some of this is taxpayer dollars ultimately. But we made a decision a number of years ago to fund a pension system. And if this is the pension system that we want funded, And if we've made a decision that we want to manage it internally, then we need to pay our people. Now, we have about $10 billion sitting there, probably a little less today than we did at the end of June. And we've asked these people to take pay cuts. And it's not from general fund dollars. It's from these dollars. And so my point here is I will support version B, but I would have also supported version C had you brought that to us. And so with that, I would just urge the committee to support what the investment council is doing. I think you're doing a great job, and just hope you continue.
Thank you. Other comments? Representative Consett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also want to throw my hat in the ring on the back of the speaker by saying what a great job that you are doing as South Dakota Investment Council. I was recently had the privilege of meeting with some people in the investment community on a national level, and your reputation throughout the country is very on a very high level. So thank you for what you do.
Thank you. Other comments? All right. Seeing none, we have a motion by Senator Tiedemann and a second by Representative Rausch to go along with the proposal of Plan B. I'll ask the Secretary to call the roll. All in favor say aye. Opposed, no.
We're going to do a roll call?
Yes, we are.
Thank you.
Is that all right?
Yes, that's what I was going to ask for.
We will take a roll call. Please call the roll.
All right. Senators Gray.
Aye.
Humstead.
Aye.
Maher.
Aye.
Nelson.
Aye.
Tiedemann.
Aye.
Teason. Representatives Abdullah.
Aye.
Carson.
Aye.
Consett.
Aye.
Feinstein.
Aye.
Lucas.
Aye.
Rausch.
Aye.
Benner.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cutler.
Aye.
And Chair Turbeville.
Aye.
Passed unanimously.
Thank you. Gentlemen, I agree with all of the comments made by the committee. You've done an absolutely wonderful job. We do appreciate it. And I would hope, as Senator Gray had said, that as we get into the budget this next year, I would urge those members of the Appropriations Committee to look to see whether or not it is not possible to compensate as you'd proposed in your C proposal. I would be a big supporter of that. But thank you for appearing here today.
Yes. If you do executive session, did you want me to leave?
Well, here's what we're going to do. We're not sitting too bad on time. Next on the agenda is Rob Wiley. And Mr. Wiley said that he only needs a few minutes. Then what I'm going to do, if it's all right with the board, we have a report on the Dakota Corps Scholarship Program from Tony Van Heusen, the governor's office, and he has to be on the road shortly after 12 o'clock. So we will bring him in, and then we will go back to the investment officer's incentive payment. If you would, please stay around for that.
Thank you.
Mr. Wiley.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Thank you. I will, as you mentioned, take just a second of your time. The fact is that what you heard just a couple minutes ago is really the half of the story, and I'd like to give you what's the actual result of that great performance that we just saw. If you'll jump right away to page one, if you look at this page and reading from the top, we give an alternative investment performance on the far left, 22%, 25%, and 27%. The time we put this together, we didn't know exactly how it would turn out, but we knew the range. The short answer of this, if you look at this 25.8%, which was just reported to you, and then follow that line across the page, that's on an actuarial funded basis, that's 96%. On a market value funded basis, that's 102% or slightly more than that. And as far as a cushion, a reserve has now been accumulated into the retirement system of approximately $500 million. good performance has done amazing things. If you go to the bottom of the page, down to the second to the last item, 2010, June, it's 96%, but we were 88% funded on a market value basis. We made up that much ground to catch ourselves up to be what is in the pension industry considered full funding. We don't necessarily ascribe to that same terminology here at SDRS and here in South Dakota, but what that says is effectively we have the dollars in the bank as of June 30th that were equal to or greater than the present value of the, all of the future liabilities of the system. That is, if it's a mortgage, the value of your mortgage is by far now greater than the any sort of liabilities that you have on that mortgage. You've now fully funded on this snapshot basis those liabilities. We may be one of only a couple states in the nation that are in this condition. The average plan is running slightly below 80% funded at this point. A good choice is made by yourself, the governor's office, the stakeholders of the retirement system, the trustees of the retirement system, the investment council. It is a package of good decisions that have been made that have brought us to this position. That is the message for the most part that I want to give you today. The easiest message for you to carry is if we're back at 100% funded, the retirees of the South Dakota retirement system roll back up to a 3.1% COLA on July 1 of 2012. For an immediate effect, that is the direct result of this better performance. The other items going forward, if you could go to page 3 for just a second. The bottom line talks about whether or not we're fully funded going forward, and everything that says 100% means that we're in a position that we can move forward indefinitely based on these assumptions moving forward. So it's that measure through 2020 is effectively very positive for us and for all the citizens of the state, along with specifically the stakeholders in this plan. That's my very quick on SDRS and the funded status. Note that this is not finalized yet. The investment performance numbers are done, but we still need to go through our actuarial performance information. That'll be done later on this fall, but the expectation is that there may be some variance, but it should be very limited.
Thank you. Any questions or comments from the committee? Yes, Representative Feinstein.
I guess this question, I guess, was brought to my attention by Senator Gray. Since June 30th, what's happened and where are we? Do we have to be at least looking at that? I mean, SDRS.
The short answer is just like every organization, you do a snapshot in time type analysis. You don't try and build on the interim. Effectively, you have a specific point in time, and that point in time is June 30th, and so these numbers are booked, if you will, at that point in time. We had a meeting with the Investment Council earlier today. Matt can jump in or someone from staff there. The number is approximately down 7% this fiscal year. If you look at that, you know, to roll you back maybe 95 or 96% funded, so it's still an outstanding position either way.
Other questions or comments?
Just the only other things that I have, sir, are with the cement plant retirement system. You remember the cement plant is a closed plan right now. This is on page 4 and 5 and 6, and the cement plant has worked its way back with approximately a 25% return to 91% funded. It is for all practical purposes, it's in great shape. But we know this plan is terminating. It is going to run the numbers out. You know, we're going to pay out everybody as we go. There's only a few hundred people in the plan. The unfunded portion, that is the expected liability stream, the value of the expected liability stream is approximately $5 million greater than the assets right now. If you look at the last page of the exhibit, we are right now at approximately 91% funded in 2011. That will, in all honesty, the stream of payments out to the individuals who are the members of the plan will slightly erode that plan, and depending on performance will determine how long that holds up. At some point, it may be that the Appropriations Committee or some design in the whole process will have to be considering how we can shore up this plan in the long run. Again, it is not very many people. It'll stretch out for a while. Does not require action today or any time immediately, but ultimately the plan is under the current expectations will work its way out of existence over the next 30 or 40 years. And that's what I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any other comments, questions? Well, Mr. Wiley did point out I misspoke earlier when I said that Jackie Storm was with the Investment Council. She's not. She's with the South Dakota Retirement System. Is that correct, Jackie? Okay, I apologize for that. But to me, that's good news because I'm a member of the South Dakota Retirement System. And so with the addition of you to the staff and a major lifestyle change, I should be able to reap the rewards for many, many years. So. Thank you, Mr. Wiley. All right. Tony Van Heusen. Okay, you're buying that. If you would, please. We will now have a report on the Dakota Core Scholarship Program.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the Executive Board. I'm Tony Van Heusen with the Governor's Office. With me today is my backup, is Paul Terman with the South Dakota Board of Regents staff. I mentioned to Mr. Fry, and I would tell you also that I'm not going to be leaving today town now until about 1, so I have more than 15 minutes if we require it. Mr. Fry had asked me to give a general report on the Dakota Core Scholarship. He didn't mention any specific questions or lines of questioning, so I'm just going to give a general overview, and any questions you have that arrive, of course, I'll be happy to answer. We just handed out copies of the annual report that the Board of Regents had assembled. I'd first mention that this has kind of been a year of transition for this program. The Dakota Core Scholarship was created by Governor Rounds and was administered within his office by Dale Birch, who was a policy advisor for him. And the administration of the program overall was done by the Education Assistance Corporation. Obviously, we have a new governor now, and I have taken over the role of overseeing this for him. Also, because of the federal reforms in student loans, Education Assistance Corporation is no longer involved in the administration of Dakota Core. As of July 1st, that was transitioned to the State Board of Regents, who has gained experience by administering the South Dakota Opportunity Scholarship. So Paul and I don't necessarily have the institutional memory that might have been there in the past, but I'm going to give you the overview as best I can. This is a program that was created by Governor Rounds. It was a concept he talked about in his campaign for governor in 2002. During his first legislative session, he proposed legislation to create this program using state funds. That legislation failed because of disputes over how the program would work with private institutions. That was the same challenge that was faced by the Opportunity Scholarship, although that program eventually overcame it. Rather than attempting the legislation again, Governor Rounds decided to create this as a privately funded, or rather a program that was not funded through the legislature or by general funds. It has been funded over the years by future fund grants, by donations from the Great Plains Foundation, by donations from Sanford Health, Avera, and Great Western Bank, and by more recently dollars that have come from Alliance, which is the fund that relates to the student savings accounts plans that are housed within the South Dakota Investment Council. The concept of Dakota Core is, unlike the Opportunity Scholarship, which gives a $1,000 scholarship to a very large number of students, to anyone who qualifies, this program is very focused. It pays all of the tuition and fees at a state institution based on the in-state rate to a certain number of students who make a commitment to spend 5 years in South Dakota after graduation in a high-need field, that need being defined according to information from the Department of Labor. Those high-need fields have been teachers in certain areas, music, special education, math and science, nursing specifically, and also other allied health fields. And just more recently, I think in the last year, they've also added large animal veterinarians. The eligibility requirements are a 2.8 high school GPA and a 24 ACT, although because of the relatively small number of scholarships that are given out year to year, the recipients all tend to be substantially above those qualification marks. As I said, these recipients are asked to make a five-year commitment. The program was started, I believe, in 2004. And so in addition to the funding sources I've mentioned, the other funding source that has become pretty important is those students who fail to meet the five-year commitment. If that happens, their scholarship is converted into a student loan on the same terms as a federal student loan, and they're asked to repay back their scholarship prorated according to how much of their commitment they met. So if they worked in the field for 2 years and not the latter three, they have to pay back 60%. As those funds are paid back into the Dakota Core Scholarship, they're used to grant out further scholarships. Because the program has always been administered in a conservative manner, this past year, the reserve funds that have been built up in the program from the payment back of those loans has allowed us to fund it entirely with those funds. Looking forward, we had 30 recipients this year in the areas that I mentioned. Governor Dugard is going to be working with the other involved people, particularly Harvey Jewett, who is the chairman of the Great Plains Foundation, to identify new corporate sponsors or approach the current ones about recommitting to this program. It has, looking back at some of the data, it's been going on long enough now that we can begin to gauge how successful we've been. The first year of scholarships were in 2004. 84 scholarships were awarded that year. Of those, 33 have failed to meet their five-year commitment, so just under half. 29 are currently making their commitment, and then there are a handful of others who are still in graduate school or the like. So we're seeing a little bit better than half that are meeting their commitment, which I think is a pretty good success for a program like this. Of course, there's no cost to the state or to the program ultimately if somebody fails to meet it. One thing I should have mentioned before, the issue of private schools versus public schools was what derailed this in the legislature. The way that that was resolved when the program was created is that private schools who accept students with this scholarship are asked to waive any tuition and fees beyond the scholarship amount, or another way of saying it is to grant them through scholarships the amount of money they would need to make that up. To my knowledge, there's only one private university in the state that has declined to participate in the program because of those terms. The majority of the students go to public universities, obviously, which reflects the overall number of students in the state. That is a brief overview. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have that emerge from that.
Questions from the committee? Senator Tiedemann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this goes back, Tony, a number of years ago when the Investment Council got out of the scholarship business and said to the executive board, we would like to see us no longer awarding scholarships. And at that time, the executive board voted to take the Alliance money and dedicate it to the Dakota Corps scholarship. And with that, at that time, a deal was cut or whatever, that there would be a representative from the Senate and a representative from the House of Representatives that would be part of the selection committee because of the commitment. And I think last year, if not right at the last meeting, I believe Mr. Clark reported that was almost $1 million that was coming in from the Alliance going into the Dakota Corps scholarship.
I think it's $800,000 a year.
So it's dollars that we would like to have some input on the selection process as we go forward.
Yeah, and I think that's very fair. I mentioned at the beginning that we've had about a complete turnover, and my honest response would be that I wasn't aware until about a week ago that there had been legislators appointed to this. The legislators who had been appointed, I don't believe either of them are in their current, or no, it was Senator Hunstad and Representative Tom Dietrich, I believe. And we'd certainly welcome the executive board making new appointments to the board to help administer the program.
Senator Cutler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You may not have the institutional memory for this question, but maybe someone here, including Senator Tiedemann, might. Who originally set the qualifications at 2.8 for GPA and 24 for an ACT? Do you know?
My understanding is that it was Governor Rounds who suggested those, but I don't know that with certainty.
One other question, if I might. Who, if you don't mind saying, who is the, which university declined to?
It's Dakota Wesleyan University. And I've spoken to their president about that. And his position is that Dakota Wesleyan is willing to waive the extra cost or grant scholarships, but they do not want to go through the paperwork that's necessary to demonstrate that they have done that, which I guess is their prerogative.
Thank you.
Other questions, comments? Representative Lucas.
Mr. Chairman.
Just a moment. Representative Lucas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. Are we recovering then the loans for those that have opted out of their requirement of the 5 years in a critical shortage area?
Yeah. Yes, as those loans are repaid, they're repaid on the same terms as a federal student loan, and they go back into the fund to be reawarded. And my understanding is that the repayment rates have been very high because obviously these students, even if they're not staying in the state, they're all employed in pretty marketable fields. So, in fact, I know for a while the problem was that in the nursing field, that students were being attracted to other states where the pay and the bonuses were enough higher that they made up for the entire loan right off the bat, and there's only so much you can do, I guess. So.
Senator Hunstad.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. In partial answer of the requirement of GPA or whatever, is there are a lot of folks that apply for these. There's a lot of dollars, but a full boat ride is a lucrative thing to try out for. So generally speaking, you're going to have to have, you're going to have to be an exceptional person probably in order to win one of these scholarships. And that is what I've learned from sitting through the meetings. And if that answers anything, it just gives us a cutoff point, because generally what we'll end up with in a meeting is a list of 500 that we're going to, we then somebody ranks them for us, and then we look at it. It's not like we don't move them around maybe on that ranking list, but there'll be people applying for jobs that are not very critical, or education's not very critical, and probably it's a good cutoff because there's so many that actually meet those requirements already. Thank you.
All right, this question I've got for you, Senator. When was the last time you attended one of these meetings?
It wasn't last year before session. It was the year before that before session, and I had kind of forgotten that I hadn't heard, and I hadn't really thought about the fact that I hadn't heard either. So,
all right.
But usually it's. To answer your question better, I've found that it's usually been in about December time frame or something.
All right. And when you were appointed, did they give you any term? Like, were you appointed for a specific period of time?
As I recall, I happened to be on the e-board during the time when this transition happened, and several of us, the other member who was on it, talked about how we thought we should have some input to it, as Senator Tiedemann said, and I just happened to be here.
All right.
I mean, I was one of the spoke for it, and my fellows around the table elected me to that position. That was how it happened.
Well, obviously, we need to have... two individuals, one from the House and one from the Senate, appointed to this position, and I'm open to suggestions if we would. We can do this at our next e-board meeting with recommendations from leadership or whomever, we can rely on leadership to make the appointments. So what's the thoughts of the board, Representative Roush?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you were looking for some names from the House, I'd certainly be happy to give those out. One that pops into my head immediately would be Representative Jackie Sly, would be a good representative from the House for education.
I agree. Senator Gray, do you have anyone that you feel would be...
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would take a little different approach, and we need two people, one from the Senate, one from the House. I would suggest one Republican, one Democrat. I would, I guess, if appropriate, I would move at this time that the chair and the vice chair and the ranking minority member of the executive board make those appointments.
Is there a second to that?
Second.
Second by the left side of the committee? All right. Any other questions or comments? All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? We'll be done. Thank you. Tony, excellent job. This was very educational. We do appreciate this.
Thank you. And I just let you know, as you make those appointments, the major business that this committee does is awarding those appointments, which is in about March. And then there is some... routine business having to do with granting exceptions or flexibility for individual circumstances that happens throughout the year, but we'll certainly welcome your appointees when they're made. So,
well, what we'll do is the executive committee, executive board, will get together between now and the next meeting and come up with two appointments and bring those to you at our next meeting. Okay.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you. All right, let's go back to our agenda. It's noon, but let's take the approval of the investment officer's incentive payment, do that in executive session. Representative Abdella. How about a five-minute break? Granted. Good. Okay, back to our agenda for today. Report from the Department of Corrections. Denny Kimmick, if you would please, sir. We had a request in light of an incident, another one that... had to do with the prison or a prisoner, and So I guess I've asked the secretary to come back and just briefly go through what you feel is in the best interest of the committee and the legislature, and I guess if there's anything that you feel might be pertinent to discuss as far as legislative help that we can give you in any way, shape, or form. And so we're just going to entertain the report on behalf of the secretary. There'll be no public testimony, questions from the committee. And with that, sir, if you would like to start, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. And you all should have received a copy of our report. And please go through that. I will use that as a template to go through this. And if you have questions, please ask. On July 1st, parolee James McVeigh left the community transition program located at Unit C of the Jamison Annex without authorization. And July the 2nd, the body of 75-year-old Mabel Shine was found in her Sioux Falls home. She had been murdered and her car was missing. McVeigh was located in Madison, Wisconsin in her vehicle and located by the GPS system that was on her vehicle. And he's since been charged with murder first degree and burglary first degree. In this report, I will attempt to go over his parole, his sentencing, chronological order of events, and communication with the Nebraska Department of Corrections. We will look at the communications regarding Secret Service, McVeigh's mental health and substance abuse status, and his criminal record and risk management as well. He went out on what we call a programmed release date, and if you look at SDCL 24-15A38, basically says each inmate shall be received from incarceration to parole supervision without a hearing with the board at the time of the inmate's initial parole date if the inmate has substantially met the requirements of the individual program directive, his IPD, established by the department and agreed to the conditions of supervision and has approved parole release plan. McVeigh was compliant on his IPD, and he went out to his programmed release date into the CTP unit where he walked away from. We had him 45 days after his Nebraska sentence went away. His IPD basically was that he needed to conduct himself with, have his programming, not be have negative conduct write-ups in the institution. He needed an approved release plan and agreed to supervision conditions. And he can also, if he does not like those conditions, appeal that to the parole board. The CTP program is used for those individuals who have a problem finding places in the community to live. Maybe they burn their bridges and they have no family. So they are placed in there if they have difficulty find a place in the community or don't have any money in order to buy or to rent an apartment or put a deposit down on that apartment. In McVeigh's case, he was doing 40% of his sentence required by considering his number of felonies. They range in individuals from 25% to 75% based on violence and number of felonies that he has had. McVeigh had his IPD issued in 2006. If you look at his sentences, it was a complex set of circumstances here. He had three sentences, two from South Dakota, one from Nebraska, that were running concurrently. In other words, they were running at the same time. He had a grand theft that he was initially put into the penitentiary from Pennington County in the theft of a motorcycle, where he received 5 years with 2 years suspended. The theft, after he walked away, he was arrested in Sioux City, Nebraska, and charged with receiving stolen property. From that, he received a sentence of 4 years from Nebraska, and he was given time served for the time that he had spent inside county jail in Nebraska. Nebraska has kind of a good time credit where it's similar to what our old system was. If he was sentenced here and sentenced to 4 years, as soon as he started serving that time, the other time, the good time come together, and he served half of his time and ended up serving 2 years of that sentence. So when he was released from Nebraska and brought back to South Dakota, he was finished with the sentence in Nebraska. He was not on supervision for that. He was brought back here, and he was put in the disciplinary segregation for the 2009 walkaway that he had done here for discipline for that. And then he was released to supervision the day on June 30th. If you go through and look on page 4 there as well, it gives a more of a description on the crimes that he was convicted of, the three crimes and the sentences. One of the interesting things in question that we had coming out of Corrections Commission, and other people have asked the question, used to be that if you were giving a sentence on an escape, that you that had to be served consecutively to the other crime that you were in for. And it was changed a few years ago to where it could run concurrently. Now, a judge has got to state that in his sentence. If a judge states that you are sentenced to 4 years or 5 years on an escape, and he does not make any mention of it, it is considered consecutive. If he is, if it is concurrent, it has to be listed in the sentence, and this one was listed in the sentence, and it was concurrent. On page 5, you will see the... Again, the talk of the different sentences and the chronological order of events. Down on the bottom of page 5, on 5/11/2011 is when he was brought into the South Dakota Penitentiary and disciplinary segregation due to the walkaway, and then released on the 30th, and the murder happening that next day. There's been some talk and questions about the records that we received from McVeigh's compliance in Nebraska. There was a two-page discharge summary that was brought with him when McVeigh was brought into the DOC, into the penitentiary here in South Dakota. Our case manager faxed a letter to the Nebraska DOC on the 12th of May requesting disciplinary work and programming information, and no response was received. His transition manager called the Nebraska Department of Corrections and was told twice that the information was confidential. On July 8th of 2011, South Dakota Lori Feiler, with the deputy of my department, received a phone call from a senior staff in Nebraska's Department of Corrections regarding McVeigh's stay in Nebraska. In this conversation, Nebraska reported there was an error when they publicly indicated at first that they had not received a request from us, and then they found out and apologized for the fact that we were told that it was confidential. We should have received that information. We did receive that information verbally on the 8th and then in writing on the 11th, and the information that was included in there just showed a couple minor write-ups, and if with that, it would not have changed his compliance. He still would have been compliant. We do not use minor write-up violations as far as looking at compliance, only majors. There's also been talk about the contact with the Secret Service. The contact with the Secret Service was with Nebraska in the county jail in Nebraska before he entered the Nebraska Department of Corrections. And the information, he was interviewed, and the response was is the case was closed, and he was not interviewed in the Department of Corrections in South Dakota on that issue as well. McVeigh's mental health status and substance abuse and aftercare. McVeigh did receive mental health services while in the Nebraska DOC. There's nothing in these mental health records that would have changed McVeigh's compliance as well. McVeigh was seen by a mental health clinician on May 13 and by a psychiatrist on May 23rd, both in our facility, following the transfer here. He also was able to meet with mental health officials daily in the daily rounds in the disciplinary segregation where he was being held. McVeigh presented as organized, coherent, and stable. At the time of the visit with a psychiatrist, he is reported to have been motivated to engage in services and make positive life changes. He did not present a delusional, aggressive, or psychotic during his stay in segregation or the day residing in Unit C prior to his absconding. While McVeigh was in custody at South Dakota, he did not present any extreme behaviors reported or witnessed as we watched the news item from Wisconsin. I also want to just note here that mental health in and of itself is not an indicator of violence, that a person that has mental health problems is no more prone to violence than the regular population is. In the risk assessment that we do, there are a number of them. The prominent one is the level of service inventory, the LSI-R score, which placed him at 27. And 27 is the median, the moderate. There are two above it and two below it. The mental health staff listed him as needing periodic mental health access. McVeigh was not given an updated LSIR when he was brought back into our custody in May of this year. His initial community risk score was assessed as maximum on a five-level scale of intensive being the top one, maximum, medium, minimum, and indirect. In South Dakota, we use a master assessment priority system called MAPS, and we try to merge the different assessments into one to give us an idea of what we're dealing with. On the MAPS score of 20, with MAPS scores, 20 and above are typically identified for specific law enforcement release alerts. McVeigh scored 11 on the MAPS. A little bit about the community transition program. We have a number of parolees that have gone through the community transition program, and that is housed in Unit C as well. Unit C has our minimal inmates, and it also has our CTP program there. The CTP program was put in after the 2003 Adult Corrections Workshop that Governor Rounds had initiated. We ended up, from looking at the community transition program from October 13 of 2004 until June 30 of 2011, 406 offenders have participated in our CTP program. 3,912 have been released in the program, and 2,917 successfully completed it. And that's pretty amazing considering these are some of the ones that can't put a parole plan together or don't have any other place to go or have burnt bridges elsewhere. So 75% of those completed the CTP program, and out of those, 65% successfully paroled from that number. So those are remarkable numbers. Just to give you an idea a little bit about the offender numbers and releases that we do. In 2011, there were 3,455 state inmates incarcerated. That's the daily average count. In 2011, we released 2,861 from prison. 2,490 released a parole or suspended sentence, and 371 flatted their sentence. Considering we have around 185 lifers in the institution and some other individuals that are serving a long sentence, 82% of the population of the penitentiary turned over last year. That's a lot of releases. That's 2,884 releases. 2,861 releases. Out-of-state caseload, we do have currently 53 inmates serving South Dakota prison sentence in other jurisdictions. Part of that is interstate compact agreement, where we end up trading prisoners with other states. Maybe they were originally from South Dakota, and another state will bring them into South Dakota. Or if we have those from other states, we will do the same, so they can be nearer to their home and have visits from their family and friends. And then we have others that are serving a concurrent sentence elsewhere, and sometimes we don't even receive those individuals in our institution. If we have someone who is serving a sentence here or was arrested after they were serving another sentence and their sentence is longer in another state, many times we don't even see those individuals in our institution. From that, I think I will go, unless there's other questions here, I will go to the after incident actions. Is there other questions of the basic report, or do you want to wait until we're done with that?
Let's see if there are any questions up to this point. Anything from the committee? Senator Cutler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Secretary, on page 6, when you were going through the Nebraska records and McVeigh's compliance, in the last paragraph under subsection 4 on page 6, the report says his allegations were not, I assume that should be corroborated by staff reports or records, but so am I reading this correctly, that he did write letters, and he wrote these letters, but the staff were not aware of these letters? Is that?
The letters he claimed, let me see here, mentally ill staff 2009. By staff, our records, we don't have any records of that. He did write letters to the governor and to the Secretary of Corrections, Reich, when he was in the institution the first time. And they were very coherent letters about how he had made a mess out of his life and how he planned to do better in the future and some ideas of how we could improve the system. But any indication of this, we did not have.
Follow-up, Mr.
Chairman. Go ahead.
So what this paragraph is really saying is that the staff couldn't corroborate any instability that he claims he was
told us about, yeah.
That he told you about, and that's the part they can't corroborate, that they were never made aware by him or their own observation that he was too unstable.
That's
is that
correct. That's correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right, please go on.
Okay, if we look at the after incident actions that we looked at, 1, 2, and 3 are from the same premise. If someone leaves the CTP program and goes off grounds without permission when they're not authorized to do, and if they're in the CTP program for the first number of hours, and also if you are in programming, which he was in CD programming, he was not allowed to leave the grounds. If someone like that today leaves the grounds, three things will happen. There'll be a warrant issued for him. There'll be a state radio broadcast for a state case, and also a four-hour broadcast on that. And also there'll be a press release stating that this individual had walked away. And that is some changes, and all three of those have been implemented. Review inmates, number 4. Review inmates placed in minimal facilities who are identified as severely mentally ill or have prior placements in the correctional mental health unit for adjustment to a psychotropic medication. In other words, if medication is started or changed in an individual within the 6 weeks prior to being released, they will have a interview with a master-level clinician or a psychiatrist, an assessment done. This does not fit in the McVeigh case, but through our review, we identified this and made the change. McVeigh was on a mild antidepressant anxiety medication, and that's all. Number 5, review all inmates identified as severely mentally ill that have been placed in the mental health unit within 1 month prior to being released from prison. A review will be conducted by a master-level clinician or a psychiatrist. This was done in the McVeigh case. However, now we've also put it into policy. Number six, revised practices regarding inmates released from segregation to parole or discharge. Inmates will not be released to community supervision directly from disciplinary or administrative segregation unless ordered by the parole board for those individuals that are under the direction of the parole board. B, the additional case management will be provided for offenders in segregation with release dates within 1 month. And C, if an inmate does discharge from parole segregation, there will be a specific law enforcement notification. These are difficult cases sometimes, and it really isn't in the McVeigh case because he was did not give us any problem in disciplinary segregation at all. He was there from his 09 walk away, but he did not give us any problems. He was always in a good mood and did not show any indications of problems. However, we do have a number of individuals. We released 371 last year that flatted their sentence. Now, from that, I can't tell you how many were in segregation, in disciplinary segregation, but those are concerning for the ones that flat their sentence. In other words, the parole board has looked at them and stated they are not a good candidate for release to the community, but sometime they're going to get out anyway. About 95% of the population is going to get out at some time. And so we are trying to move individuals out of disciplinary segregation within a month of segregation, and you know, and when we determine that that's where it's going to be, they release right to the street from disciplinary segregation. It's not ideal. We have put a lot of practices in place over the years in order to deal with these individuals, and we added another one in this last while to where, and we put it to practice a number of times so far, is if the individual flats to the street, they are going to hopefully tell us where they were going, although they have no need to do that if they don't want to. What we are trying to do is find where they're going to release to, allow that release to happen, and then after a period of time, however long it takes to get where they're going, like we had one to North Dakota a few weeks ago, we called the authorities in North Dakota, asked them to go out and put eyes on him. And they went and knocked on the door, confirmed that he was there. It provided us with the understanding he did go where he said he was going to go. And another thing that helps with that as well is that now he knows that the authorities back home know that he is home. And I think that serves a valuable purpose on both sides of the item here. So we're trying to get that done, and hopefully we will continue to be successful at that. Number seven, analyze case management provisions and the application of initial presumptive parole process with out-of-state inmate cases. And number eight is closely tied with that. And what we would look for, we are looking at right now inside senior staff and maybe asking for legislation that when we have someone who has been out of state and we bring them back inside the institution, that and we can't get good records or complete records from another state, we may ask the legislature to be able to delay that release for a period of time for us to be able to get those records. And that's something that we're working on right now. And, of course, that would not go past their flat date. It would go for their conditional release date that they have. Number nine, provide specific notification to state and local law enforcement when an inmate is discharged or paroled directly from administrative or disciplinary segregation. Kind of ties back with that other one a little bit. We do notify law enforcement in the place where an inmate's going to go back, but when you consider 2,880 releases last year, that is a lot of notifications that local law enforcement get, especially if you're in a Sioux Falls or a Rapid City. And we want to be careful not to dilute that, because if we dilute that with just another one that release, we want this to be a specific release that the person we do consider some concern with him releasing and is releasing from segregation, and he is high risk. And so we are working on that process as well to give them special notification. And then number 11 is to conduct an update assessment prior to parole release on inmates returning from out of state. We are looking to do the LSIR and other assessments in an individual, even though they may have a short time to serve here, and we really probably do not have a lot of programming that we are going to do with them. There's one other item on here, and then I'll ask for questions that's not on your item or on your report there. But we are in the process of starting Nexle, NIXLE.com. Nexle is an organization through the internet where if you want to find out what's going on in your communities and the communities that have that, you go to Nexle.com and sign up for your cell phone, and you can get emails and texts on your cell phone from information that law enforcement or other organizations are putting out. We learned this from the Mitchell Police Department. They use it extensively there. They used it a few weeks ago where they had propane, city natural gas leaking from a house, and they took an area of like 5 or 6 blocks from that house, and those individuals in there were got a text message that there's natural gas leaking, please leave your house and walk out of the area. And some of them did that from that text messaging. This message can go out to for walkaways or for escapes or any other hazards that we may have at one of our facilities. And we're going to look at, we're signing up today, we're training our people on how to use it. And so many of you can find out what's going on in DOC. You can go to Nexle.com. You put in the zip code of the area you want notified from, if you just want the pen from Sioux Falls or if you want Springfield or Pier, Rapid City or juvenile units in Custer. You can receive that information. And so we're hopefully going to be able to let people know what's going on at a quicker time. If you give it to the news media, of course, you're going to wait for the half hour, hour on the radio, and you're going to wait till the evening news or the paper the next day. And this way we can get that information out as quickly, and you can center it to within so many blocks or a square mile or the whole state of South Dakota.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Cutler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I apologize, I haven't been out to your website lately, and I just wondered if this report is on your website.
Michael was directed to get it there, and I'm assuming that it is. If it's not, I will make sure it is, but I'm sure that it is.
Thank you.
Okay, it is there. Okay, thank you.
Any other questions, comments? Representative Abdellah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Secretary, in my... going back to the sentence, 516.09, he was sentenced out of Nebraska for receiving stolen property over a term of 4 years. Excuse me. And then on 516.09, he was sentenced in Minnehaha County for 5 years to run concurrent for escape. Is that correct?
He was sentenced actually in 2010 for okay. his – they brought him back up here after he was sentenced in Nebraska. He was brought back up here and sentenced for his escape here, and then it was also in the sentence that not only run concurrently, but it also was retroactive, so he was given credit for time served.
Okay, that's the way I understand it now. Obviously, the Department of Corrections is getting some heat over this, and what I'm wondering is why you haven't told the media exactly what you just told me, that he was sentenced to run concurrent for his escape attempt. You know, the courts escape a lot of this stuff by pulling this stuff, and somebody else gets blamed for it. And I'm wondering why your department chooses not to explain that to the press. No fault of yours. It just looks like you're covering for the judicial system.
Well, we have stated that with those that have asked that it's concurrent, but I don't know what the judge has in front of them when they make their decision, and their decisions that they make are theirs, and the decisions that we make are ours. So I don't know what was going on there, and that's the judge's responsibility.
I understand that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions? Anyone? Senator Gray.
I don't know if this is so much question as it is commentary, if I might. You know, my mom always said to not talk about things you don't know much about, so maybe I should just shut up right now. But I'm bothered by some things, and Mr. Kamek, I appreciate you being here. I know you're new on the job. Welcome to the Department of Corrections.
Thank you.
It's got to be one of the funnest secretary jobs. You know, I think we need to be careful not to overreact. Having said that, I see some problems. And I'm glad to see that Mr. Kamek and his department are addressing some things on their level. But until this legislature, until the state decides we're going to do something about judicial sentences and corrections budgets, we're going to continue to have some problems. I mean, I just kind of glanced through this, and I wrote down a few things about parole eligibility. This guy got a sentence of 5 years. 2 years were suspended by the judge, leaving him with 3 years. And so he had to serve 40% of that to get to his first parole eligibility. Now, he didn't make that parole eligibility. I understand that. But 1 year, 2 months, and 12 days on an original five-year sentence? Are you kidding me? If you were the victim of that and the offender was out in 1 year, that's offensive to me. 2,861 releases last year, 86% turnover. You know, I think what happens is you have prosecutors who have discretion, and so they're able to cut deals. Judges are able to suspend sentences. Corrections department is able to grant people on parole. So you have someone going and committing an offense, and they're doing a fraction of what they were charged with. Now I also go to the incident that happened in Rapid City earlier this month. Two officers dead. Daniel Tiger, August 2007, assault on an officer, gets probation. March 2008, assault on an officer, 2 years in prison. He's out in 6 months.
I have the other, and you can if I still have this wrong,
but he ended up going back in and serving because he violated parole.
He was out several days. He went out compliant on parole, served several days, and then come back in and then was set to flat date.
Yeah, and that's fair, and that's how I had read it too. But I also read that he was out in 6 months on his original parole. Seems crazy to me. We've changed the law in recent years to allow escape to be conserved concurrently rather than consecutively. Now a judge gets to make that decision ultimately. You know, ultimately, I think we as a state, we as a legislature, need to find a way to deal with, Rapid City Journal described them as frequent flyers. Right now, it's a revolving door, and until we decide we're going to spend some more money in corrections and courts and get these people off the streets that need to be off the streets, we're going to continue to have these problems. Now, again, you know, I don't want to be the one to overreact, because I know there's people who go do their time, they get out, and they're productive members of society. They're making money to support their family, and that's ultimately where we need them to be. But there's a number of people who aren't. They're a revolving door. They're not going to be a first-time visitor. They're going to be a two- and three- and four-time visitor. We see it every year. The news media has accounts of people who are on their fifth, sixth, seventh DUI. It's crazy to me. So I'll get off my soapbox here and quit lecturing, but until we as a legislature decide to do something about it, we're going to continue to see this stuff.
Thank you. Further questions, Representative Lucas, or comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, first comment, just to follow up on Senator Gray's, I would add to that the individual that you talked about in Rapid also had a firearm with a convicted felony charge. So it isn't just the laws we make and how they're applied in the judicial system. There's a lot of people that just have complete disregard for the law and choose to keep violating it, whether it's the DUIs or, you know, violating the conditions of their release from prison. And to me, that's probably the million-dollar question, how we many of those behaviors are affected early in life, and by the time they get to Secretary Kamek, it's more difficult to change their behaviors. But one question I have is on number 9 there of the after-incident action plan, the additional notification to law enforcement. If they're in the community transition program, you know, how are they going to find, you know, if they have a place to stay and they're out, then the law enforcement officers can knock on their door and keep an eye on them. But if they don't have a place to stay, I guess, how are they going to know that they're have violated a condition of their parole?
You're talking for about people on parole or people in the CTP program?
I think this talks about the CTE program, doesn't it?
CTP program has a number of checks where they have to check in, and so they'll know within hours of their being missing.
Go ahead.
Then McVeigh never checked back in that night. I believe he stole a knife in Walmart. Nobody made an effort that I know of to locate him, correct?
He was listed as missing, and his parole agent was notified. And the parole agent did not, of course, we did not have that media would have been notified at that point. But no, there was no other notification made.
Representative Abdullah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, just briefly to follow up on Senator Gray's remarks, I totally agree. However, I'm sort of a realist. You can put all the policemen on the street that you can get, and you can pay them an exorbitant amount of money, and God only knows they're very, very underpaid. And we do have a shortage of law enforcement officers. Nothing will prevent that incident in Rapid City from a felon carrying a firearm. And I know over the years in the legislature I've been accused of bringing all these tough bills in for public safety, and I'll continue to do that. But there again, you can pass all the laws you want, and if they're not enforced or if they're not adhered to, this guy, this McVeigh, I'm looking, has had 8 felonies. He's been convicted of 8 felonies. He could have been charged with habitual criminal years ago. That's not the fault of the DOC. That's not the fault of law enforcement. I don't know whose fault it is. But when the guy's got 8 felonies, plus DUI convictions, plus he was charged with robbery without a disposition, assault on a family member where the disposition list is a rejected charge, you know what that is, the family member that refused to prosecute. He's got 8 felonies. We don't need more laws on the books. There's enough laws on the books to take care of this guy. We can't point the finger at DOC. They can't go babysit everybody they release, and they can't keep them all in there. Senator Gray said one thing that made a lot of sense to me, which is very rare, maybe we're overreacting. It's unfortunate that this lady was murdered. It's unfortunate about the incidents in Rapid City. It's unfortunate about the incident at the institution. But they can only do so much with what they got to work with. And like I said, you could pay them. We should pay them more. But you could have all the law enforcement you can on the street, and that won't prevent somebody from carrying a gun in their waistband and murdering 2 innocent police officers.
Are there any other questions or comments? Seeing none. Well, Secretary Kamek, we thank you very much for coming forth and speaking with us, and we would look forward, if there are legislative issues coming up in 2012, you know, we would certainly support anything that you have, or I would.
Okay. Okay. Thank you very much, and appreciate appearing here. And if any of you have any questions at all, you drive home and you think of some, don't be afraid to give us a call at DOC, and we'll try to answer them for you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next item on the agenda would be the continue with the subcommittee reports, budget subcommittee report.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Carson.
Thank you very much. We had two subcommittee reports this morning. We had the LRC, which basically we instructed them to make a budget for a 36-day session, and looking at increasing the amount of dollars that are available for travel and some minor expenses to the tune of about $250,000. We voted on it. It was unanimous that we go ahead and recommend that budget going in.
Okay. Mr. Fry, if you would, please. Go right from here, it'd be fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for saving a little time, letting me speak from here. We did talk over two budgets this morning, and the committee did take one. I would note that as we crafted the budget for LRC for the coming year, as you know, we received some extra funding at the end of last year. We took that funding out. But because we are going to have to replace the computers, we put a very similar amount back in. So, and that's to the tune of about $100,000. So that sort of was a wash. But we are going to have to replace the machines. We're hoping to get by for $100,000 because we hope that at least in part we will use tablets of the iPad type format or type configuration. We don't know if we can do that for 100%. We don't know for sure how that's going to work. One of the people we had under consideration was, of course, Hewlett-Packard, and they are selling their tablet form factor out for $100, $200. They're getting out of the business. So there are going to be fewer and fewer people to work with. And I know that the Technology Committee really did like the iPad as a possible form factor. It does some things very well. It does some things perhaps not up to our standards. So we've got to make some decisions. But we do have to have that money in there because we are now or will be into the fourth year with the tablet laptops. We use some of them for the interns. They're going to be getting pretty long in the tooth. And we do pay about $20,000 a year in support costs for those. So we do have some outflow as well. So we have that to be concerned with. Going to a 36-day legislative session, which is what we budgeted for this year. This year we'll use one of those days for the special session to redistrict, and then a 35-day session. Those of you who have lived through a 35-day session know that things happen very, very quickly. That session is very compressed. Deadlines come almost right away, and it's going to be pretty difficult. We hope that a 36-day session, while it won't lengthen it significantly, will be helpful, and that's a good place to start. And then there was quite a bit of discussion about legislative training and professional development and so on, and that's what the extra money would be for travel. So that would be the budget that we will present then to the governor's office of the Bureau of Finance and Management, and they'll have their shot at it, and the governor makes his recommendation. And of course, we're a long way from home even at that point, because we will then appear next year in front of the Appropriations Committee, and a lot more tweaking and twiddling will be done with our budget, depending on what the realities are of the South Dakota economy and the South Dakota revenue picture at that time. But as it stands right now, our budget would supply some money for legislative travel, and commensurate with that, of course, some money for the dues. In our original 36-day session, we were paying no dues to any of the organizations at all. Nothing to CSG, nothing to NCSL, nothing to Uniform Laws Commission, nothing to the Education Commission of the States. So we were going pretty much cold turkey and alone out there, and that's a pretty frightening prospect considering how much help we get from these people as a staff, to say nothing of the professional development that the legislature receives. So with that money for travel, that includes money for dues. It doesn't do us any good to travel to these organizations if we're not a member. So that would include some money for dues. It may not pay all of the dues right away, but then there's another budget year right after the time those dues are paid, and perhaps we can bridge into the next year. So we're hopeful of being able to remain a member, at least in semi-good standing, of most of those organizations, and we'll go from there. But that's the budget that we will then present to, unless, you know, if the board is in concurrence, we will present a budget for 36 days with about $200,000 in travel and dues money, and roughly, I believe, $100,000 to pay for new computers for the legislature for the coming 2 years. That is upfront money we have normally leased in the past. Right now, we are running out of options for leases, and we are thinking we'll have to pay for it. That means we pay it. That's front-end loaded. If we do pay for it all up front, of course, the next year, we will not have anything due except for the support costs. So it's pay me now or pay me later. In this case, we're paying them now. But and if we can work a lease deal, if we can find something, then that will help us as well. So, and we still, of course, the technology subcommittee still needs to meet, and you'll hear from them probably in the November meeting as to what actual machine they recommend. So we'll go from there. But that's the story with our budget. And thank you for your consideration.
Questions or comments, Representative Lucas?
Well, I'm not going to debate. I'll go along with the subcommittee's recommendation, but I am partial to the 40 days because this is an issue that I brought forth in 2006 that is a joint resolution, and the citizens voted in 2008 for us to have up to a 40-day session every year versus the old 40 and 35. And in fact, back in, I think, 2002, I was on Constitutional Revision Commission, and the individuals on there, and many of them were excellent constitutional scholars, recommended that the more time we give up as legislators, it gives that more of an opportunity for the executive branch of government to do things that the legislative branch should be doing. In reference to the 35-day session, I remember a lot of years we come back and spend about the first week correcting things that weren't done the year before. So, well, we got to fix this bill or law we passed the year before because we didn't get it quite right. And I think that's where we run the risk. We're going to rush through legislation. We're not going to be able to have those complete hearings that bills and resolutions deserve. And in many cases, I think we'll have mistakes made that will have to be corrected the following year.
Senator Tiedemann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, the one question I have, the 36-day session, does that have 19 or 22 interns in it?
May I respond, Mr. Chairman? Please. Thank you. At the current time, that does provide money for 19 interns at $110 a day. Now, again, as we get into the session and so on, things sometimes change, and perhaps we can squeeze one or two more out. We did do some work, and I think there will be an intern subcommittee report about the compensation, whether 110 or 125 is the appropriate number. You'll remember we went from 110 to 125 when the IRS required that we begin to withhold, and that was to make them whole while they were here. We did survey recent interns, and there will be some information from that subcommittee going forward. Sorry about the long answer. The short answer is 19.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I support the 36-day session going forward as proposed with the added travel and a portion of the dues. I think that it's going to really depend upon leadership of both the House and the Senate to make sure that the new members are alerted and that they can get the job done in that time frame, because, yes, it does become compressed. But I think it just is definitely going to be the responsibility of leadership to help move it forward.
Any further questions or comments? All right. I have one for the committee chair or Mr. Fry. When you're talking about paying some dues. Which organizations have you decided you're going to pay and which ones you're not?
I might respond to that if I could, Mr. Chairman.
Sure.
Probably what we will, if I had to make the choice today, we would make partial payments to each of them with the possible exception, you know, if I'm king, which I'm not, but I mean, but I've got to, somebody's got to make the call. Either the e-board will decide if there's a time to do that, or we would make partial payment to each of the organizations and then hope to get into the next fiscal year, and hopefully times are better and there would be sufficient dollars there and we could make the rest of the payment at that time. If there were any organization at this point, and we don't pay very much to them, but if there were any organization that we could leave behind, it would probably be the Education Commission of the States. There is some overlap there, but we only pay $17,000. I mean, so that kind of those kinds of savings just simply don't add up to enough to solve any real problems. But that would. But my recommendation to the board, and the board would make that decision, would be we would make partial payment to each of the organizations, NCSL, CSG, and Uniform Loss Commission, and then try to make it up later as best we could. So if we do it for 1 year, I don't think they're going to throw us to the curb a couple of years. Of course, it really impacts their ability to operate because we're, you know, we're a funding factor for them, and the less staff they have or the less resources they have, the less we have. And we've contacted them quite a bit over the last year for help.
Well, obviously, if this passes, we'll have to revisit our travel policy because at the present time, you're the only people that are allowed to travel on to these meetings would be members who are chairs or vice chairs or something like that. And we would also have to take a hard look at how much we're going to allow each individual to spend. In the past, we've had some legislators that have gone to every meeting that they possibly could, and if we have limited amount of funds, then we're going to have to be very careful about that. Senator Hunstead.
Yeah, thank you. Did you get the names of the groups? I was going to have Jim go through them so you'd make sure to know which ones of the dues we were talking about. I think there's only four, though.
Go ahead.
Okay. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then the four organizations that are in play here are National Conference of State Legislators, the Council of State Governments, which includes the Midwest Legislative Conference, the Uniform Laws Commission, which is the organization that drafts model laws, and we usually enact one or two of those a year. Frankly, because they develop a law for us of considerable complexity, and we're able to tag along with that. And then finally, the Education Commission of the States, which covers basically K through 20, or pre-K through 20 education issues. And those are the four organizations. One organization where we have paid all of the money the last couple of years, and that is the International Legislators Forum. That one, frankly, has kind of gone by the wayside, but, you know, if you want to put it in, we can talk about that, but right now it's not in play. We did fund the whole thing. The original deal there was the governor's office would pay five and it would pay half, and we would pay half. The last couple of years, we've paid the whole boat, and something's got to give. Again, the amount of money, again, is not that significant. We're not going to fund state government what we save there.
Further comments, questions?
Yeah.
Follow-up, right. Senator Hunstead.
To go on with that, at least part of our discussions this morning was not to definitively decide what our rules are going to be about who goes, but to get at the idea that as our economy gets some strength back in it, that we ought to fund the legislature back up, much like we talked about this morning with the Investment Council. We are going to have a time. It's important for us to pull back and not spend more money than we have when we have tough times. But it's also important that we know that we need to fund our own staff and our own selves so that we can carry on our jobs as legislators. Not you and I, because we don't know who will be elected, but whoever it is needs to have some expertise. And that was our discussion, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions or comments? Yeah, we need to vote on this, right?
You can do both at the same time because you've got Marty yet.
So. Well, I tell you what, let's The next item on the agenda would be the legislative audit fiscal year 13 budget request. But why don't we go ahead and vote on the LRC budget request. Representative Roush?
Are we going to, we're going to vote on the proposed budget from LRC, but I caught earlier that the discussion on the interns is still open. Is that going to then be in flux? Are we approving it up to a point with the exception of the intern program if we want to, I heard the discussion of 22 or 23 to 19, and then also the per diem or the rate of reimbursement, those certainly would affect our budget.
Senator Cutler.
Mr. Chairman, might I suggest that we have the report from the intern committee so that then we could, after you have the report, then we could go ahead and include the intern part of it and take care of the whole thing.
That makes sense. Representative Lucas.
In Senator Teason's absence, who's on the Rhine in Europe, I got the report for the legislative intern program. And it's been much easier for you because you haven't got Tiedemann and Teason mixed up at once today, have you?
It's worked great.
Works great.
We'll send one of them on a trip every time. The
committee's overall recommendation for the 2012 session, which would be the same, I guess, for 2013, is the 19 interns at 110 per day. That's what we have budgeted this year, and that's what we'd recommend for the 2013 session. And that totals $75,240. Now, even though it's a 35-day session, the interns come in one extra day for orientation. So that's where the 36 times 110 is computed from. Any questions on that?
Yes, Representative Roush.
Not specifically to Representative Lucas, but are the interns, will they be returning with us at special session?
Does anyone know?
Yes, please.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, interns are not going to be with us for special sessions, at least not in a paid paid capacity. So.
Okay, so as a follow-up then, it's the 36-day budget calendar would include that extra day for interns because they're only going to be 35-day session. So they won't be here for the special session, which is a day in our budget. Is that right?
No, they have a day of orientation. So I'm assuming that's the day
they
before.
They need 36 days.
Yes.
Correct.
For a 35-day
Our budget
session.
Is already 36 days. But they're not going to be here for special session. Their special day will be their orientation.
Yeah.
Okay.
Any other questions or comments? All right, we've had the legislative intern subcommittee report.
Mr. Chairman?
Just did that.
Yeah, I know. I said we've already had that.
Mr. Okay. Chairman?
Yes.
Move approval of the Legislative Intern Subcommittee report.
Is it? Second by
Tiedemann.
Senator Tiedemann. Whatever. Don't get me started. Are there any other questions or comments? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. All right, now, we still have Martin here, don't we? Marty, are you ready? Department of Legislative Audit, Fiscal Year 2013 Budget Request, Auditor General.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. I do have some copies of the handout that I mailed out to you last week, if there's anyone who would like to have one. Today, I'm not really going to cover it in much detail, but okay. If I might, Mr. Chair, I'd like to take just a minute to discuss the results of our peer review. The auditing standards that we follow require that we have every 3 years a peer review of our organization, and that's to ensure that our system of quality control is designed properly and that we're executing in accordance with our own system. And we just went through that peer review this summer, where we have people come in from the audit organizations from various states around the country, and they review our operation, and I'm happy to report that we have received a clean opinion and no written recommendations for improvement to our system. So I wanted to publicly recognize the staff of Legislative Audit, because that's as good as it gets in the peer review world, and for their commitment to quality and hard work. So with that, on to the budget. I really have no change to the budget in any of the objects for travel, contractual services, supplies and materials, or capital assets. Those parts of the budget are flat. So the only thing that I do have any increase in isn't, and it's covered on the first page, the cover page of the handout, and that is in personal services. As the rest of state government, no one in legislative audit has received a pay increase through a general salary policy for the last 3 years. However, consistent with what the executive branch has done, we have done some promotions from, we have our auditor classifications 1, 2, and 3, so forth. We've done promotions in those as have occurred within the executive branch. And so we have some people who will be eligible for promotions. They have to earn them, of course, first, but would be eligible for promotions. And so I'm asking for an additional $16,819 of salary, personal services dollars, salaries and benefits to cover the increases that would be associated with those promotions. And that's the only increase there is in the budget. Otherwise, it's a flat budget. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Representative Rausch.
Thank you, Mike. If the dollars are there and there would be some sort of across-the-board increase, would you then have to come back with an amended budget? Because your department is not automatically subject to that.
Thank you for bringing that up. If there were a general, let's say, an across-the-board increase, those are typically taken care of by the Bureau of Finance and Management. They will impact all of the state budgets for those. However, if there were a movement to job worth component of that that's part of the PACE system, there's oftentimes been an across-the-board plus a movement to job worth. Since all of the employees of Legislative Audit are exempt employees, we would not be impacted for that movement to job worth component. So if the legislature were to come forward with a package that would include a movement to job worth, I would have to factor that in and make a request to the Appropriations Committee in 2012 for the dollars that would be associated if there were happen to be a job worth component to the salary package.
Further questions of the committee? Seeing none, thank you.
Thanks for your time.
Madam Chairman.
Representative Carson.
Thank you. We discussed this at quite some time at our committees or our meeting this morning, and it was our feeling that the committee's feeling that we need to proceed forward with $16,819 in personal service because they're moving their personnel from up one rank, and that is due to them. You need to take into consideration with the stimulus money and the things that have happened in the last 2 years, these people have worked relentless, more hours, and covered more ground than what they would have without it. Thank you.
Thank you. And we'd be remiss to not acknowledge and add our congratulations to you and your staff. It's quite a successful achievement to get back a report that contains really no suggestions for you to improve. You're doing the best you can, and we want to acknowledge that as well. So thank you for that. Senator Abdallah, did you have a question or something?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I agree with Representative Carson. We don't, in the years I've been on the executive board, I've never had a problem or question with legislative audit, so if it's in order, I'll move that we accept the budget.
It's in order. It's been moved by Representative Abdallah. Is there a second? Second by Representative Kanzit. Further discussion on the motion? If not, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Are there any opposed? Okay, we're officially approved.
We still have the LRC budget has not been voted on.
And would someone like to move that?
I would move that.
Unless there is
at
further discussion or question?
I would move it at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Moved by the Speaker. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Senator Tiedemann. Further discussion on the motion? If not, do we need a roll call on this or just voice vote? Okay. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Are there any opposed? That is approved. I think we're done with our order of business. There was an issue memo request, and I don't know how the chair had decided to handle that. Mr. Fry, if you'd handle that.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. There was an issue memo request from Senator Valley to have an issue memo prepared on certain elements of the telecommunications situation in South Dakota. We've been through that a little bit. There are a couple of things that we've done. The chair and I had talked about this, and I think there are about nine separate issues in here. And I don't want to speak out of turn for the chair, but I believe what we had agreed upon is we will work on it. No, the chair's back. So, but we had agreed that we will work. We would be willing and able to work on an issue memo, but that it probably would not be doable until the spring. We would like to present it to you rather than presenting it to you in November or December of this year, which is going to really be problematic for two reasons. One, redistricting, and two, the person that was most involved with these issues was indeed Jackie Stark. And as a result, our expertise has left. So we're going to have to rebuild some of that. And for that reason, then, we would like to have a little longer opportunity. We think the quality will be better if we do that. We do have someone on the fiscal side who knows some of the elements, but certainly nowhere near all nine of them. So it's going to be a joint project. And if it's okay with you, we would certainly do it, but it probably won't get done until, well, let's say, the April meeting, and we'll present it at that point. Is that a fair recitation of what we talked about? Mr. Chairman?
Yes, it is. I agree. It's a complicated issue, and you're going to need some time on that.
If I might, Mr. Chairman.
Please, go ahead.
If the prime mover, Senator Valley, needs some specific information for this session, we'll expedite that so that he has what he needs to go forward, or so that the Commerce Committee, it would be primarily Senate Commerce, if they need something, we'll do everything we can to get the appropriate information into their hands. So,
Senator Cutler.
I'm just wondering, since this was a rather formal request by Senator Valley, will there be a more formal response to him then, so he knows that you intend to help him with his needs and then pursue a formal memorandum at a later time?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we will. We've been trying to communicate with Senator Valley. He is apparently out of town right now, but we will contact him both telephonically and in writing. So we'll be in good shape. His concerns will be allayed.
Thank you,
Representative Abdallah.
I believe the next scheduled e-board meeting would be the day after the special session, I believe. Don't we have one in October, I'm thinking? Yes, a Tuesday, October 25th is the e-board, assuming you get done with your redistricting sometime before 8 o'clock the next morning on the 25th.
All right. Is there anything else to bring? Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I just have a question regarding one of our fellow colleagues, and that was blown all over the Internet. I don't know if you want to address that in the executive session or how you want to talk about this, but it's dealing with Representative Stace Nelson and dragging the e-board into it. And I just find it really amazing that I have to read the blogs to find out that the e-boards are being dragged into this and not being heard from somebody on the e-board about what's actually going on. I'm just wondering how that all comes into play and how we're notified. So, because I don't read the blogs very often. Then when you do and all of a sudden the e-board's dragged into it, it's just like, okay, what did I miss here? So I'm just curious if you care to comment or how we want to address that.
I think for a full discussion, if you would like, we could go into executive session. Is there a motion?
I'll make that motion.
Is there a second?
Discuss the personnel matter.
Personnel matters. All in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed. Motion carried. We are now in executive session.